Now, if you go back in history a little, you'll find that George Bush's father, Prescott Sheldon Bush, was also a member of the order. He was a member of Brown Brothers Harriman, which is the Harriman Private Banking Company. So today you've got two men who are supposedly in politics in opposition, Bush and Harriman, actually the members of the same secret society. And Bush's father was not only a member, he was a partner in the what was then Harriman and Company, which later became Brown Brothers Harriman. So behind the scenes, and this is something you don't see until you investigate it, people who appear to be in opposition politically or financially or industrially or in many ways are working together. Other members might be William Buckley. Now, William Buckley became a member in 1949, but the preceding class to that was Bush, 1848. So you get Bush was amongst the 15 who selected Buckley. And Buckley's club, that 15, was the 15 that selected, for example, one of the new members for 50 was the Reverend Sloan Coffin, Jr. The Reverend Sloan Coffin, Jr. at Yale was at the core of the anti-Vietnamese war disturbances on Yale campus. This is typical. You'll find that men in the same society will take opposite positions in public.
It's Friday, it's 5 o'clock. Welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show on Friday, the 7th of October 2022, streaming live from the People's Republic of Stokes Croft Arts Centre in Bristol. And also on the new talk radio, or newish, talkradio.org.uk stream. So if you want all the details of the programme with stories, etc., links to what we're talking about, then you can go to thisweek.org.uk, plus links to the downloads. But if you want to listen to the live stream at 5 on Fridays, or actually if you want to dip into it during the rest of the week, where we're on at 11 and other times this program is on during the week, it's repeated, that is talkradio.org.uk. also, we're on at radioqUK.com in Camberley, Surrey, which they've been emailing me recently saying that it's the most downloaded of all their programs, so adding several thousand to the weekly listenership. Well done down there in Camberley, Surrey. And also, we're live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app, which is available from all good app stores, not necessarily Google. Well, I've got a bit of a beef with Google this week, you'll be hearing about in a minute. I'm Tony Gosling. Thank you for turning off the psycho in the corner, gaslighting us with military-grade, zero-carbon and Ukraine psychological warfare propaganda, as well as promoting medical misinformation sometimes as well. And the ivermectin and chloroquine treatment, particularly for COVID, which was totally suppressed by the good old mainstream press. This week, our guest is retired ASLEF train driver and secretary of the branch here in Bristol, Bernard Kennedy, navigating us through the Fourth Reich Matrix, or the World Economic Forum's Fourth Industrial Revolution, and hopefully avoiding a Third World War in the process, is Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. We'll also be joined in an hour from the Northwest by Henry Widdus, who is the chair of the National Union of Journalists Northwest Manchester branch, Northwest Lancashire, that's right. So we got all sorts for you tonight, particularly looking at China in part two. But we've got to start, haven't we, by looking at the Conservative Party conference. Bernard, so can you just tell us a little bit about how you got into train driving and when and why?
I was one of those little boys that always fancied being a train driver when I was obviously in short trousers. I started in 1980 as a guard. I always, like I said, wanted to get into the driving grade, but had to wait a few years until vacancies came up. Became a driver in 1989. Always been involved in trade unions before I was on the railway, but certainly during my time on the railway, I was active in the previous role as a guard in the NUR, and straight away got involved with ASLEF, and I was the branch secretary until I retired back in June for 22 years, and that's representing 350 drivers across nine businesses in the Bristol area. I had various other roles too during that 42 years, but particularly 30 odd as a driver, 30 plus as a driver. I was also an area rep in the freight sector, representing five depots, and that was directly doing disciplines and negotiating pay and conditions.
So this is where you're representing members when the company says they've done something wrong and they may have to have a disciplinary, may even lose their job.
Exactly, yes. I like to think I saved quite a few jobs. There were some I couldn't, but yes, exactly.
So can you, because you, I mean, certainly starting driving in the 1980s and also obviously working on the network before that, you saw it through the John Major government's privatisation of the railways. Now, it's funny, isn't it? Because Thatcher, a lot of people think, oh, Thatcher privatised the railways. She didn't, because even the most extreme conservatives in those days saw the idea of privatising the railways as ridiculous and dangerous.
That's correct. It wasn't. It was John Major and Stephen Norris who brought in the dreadful 1993 Railways Act, which we are still victim to, or we're still sort of suffering from. It's one of the worst things that's happened, I believe, to the railways ever. If you look sort of outside of the UK at European railways, for example, or even in America or as far as Japan, there have been various forms of privatisation, but nobody has chosen the ridiculous franchising system which we are still suffering from.
Well, because in the old days it was like, I mean, because in the 1980s, late 80s, I was at the BBC when they were bringing in all sorts of changes there, something called producer choice, where everything was kind of siloed up into compartments. And if one compartment wanted to deal with another compartment in this enormous corporation, then they had to go through, sort of like accounting, we have to get permission to do it. And then everyone has to be watched as they do that. Now, I know that's happened in the railways, hasn't it? Where you've got, for example, the track maintained by one organisation and the train operating company is a completely different organisation. So you've got rail track. Can you just go through those various strata? Because as I see it, at every point in that system, where it, right from the actual track bed up to the day-to-day rail services, there's somebody taking their little slice from the whole system.
So the 1993 Railways Act basically fragmented the railways completely, and it started out with the infrastructure being owned by a rail track, and they suffered sadly into the 90s with various accidents like Ladbroke Grove and Southall. And so that was brought back into public ownership and became Network Rail. But yes, people must understand that, especially those that use the railway are being ripped off, in my opinion, that the Act separated the infrastructure from the operators. So you're standing at a station, right, waiting for your train at Temple Meads or Parkway, and you want to go to London on GWR, or you want to go to cross country, north on cross country, or into Devon. That train comes in with GWR on the side, or a cross country logo. The cross country franchise and the GWR franchise don't own that train. Somebody else owns that. That's owned by what we call the Roscoes, and the Roscoes are the leasing companies that are owned by banks.
So what does that stand for, Roscoe?
you've got me.
Well, I'll look it up.
It's,
anyway.
It's basically a
rolling stock
leasing company.
Oh, okay.
I'm not sure the exact letters it stands for.
I remember looking into these years ago, these Roscoes, and I couldn't remember either. But quite a lot of the actual rolling stock is owned by banks like HSBC.
Yes, that's correct.
Which is, what the hell are HSBC doing? They're just taking their cut, aren't they, really?
Of course they are. I mean, they do have to provide the trains, which are quite expensive, but they do take the their massive cut, and the train operating companies have to pay them to hire the trains. Now, the Roscoes have to keep the trains in good order and deliver sort of that...
it's just
units.
Short for Rolling Stock Company.
Yes. So but you're quite right. They are owned by HSBC and other big banks. So initially, there was an outlay to sort of buy the trains. But after that, they just started coining the money in, very sadly.
The other thing is, and I'm not sure, you can tell us if this is true maybe, that the train operating companies are always looking at maybe cutting down the number of carriages so that they can don't have to pay these Roscoes quite so much. So, for example, going from London to Bristol or Birmingham or somewhere like that, if they can sometimes, if they can cut a few carriages off the train, they don't have to pay so much.
Well, that's right. And if they can get away with that and not get criticised by the public for sort of having overcrowded trains, but of course that doesn't happen because most of the trains these days, and particularly pre-COVID, are completely overcrowded, and there wasn't enough service. And thankfully, people are coming back now. Passengers are coming back, particularly in the leisure market. I think the business market, the commuters, is less so. But no, that's very true. But there's also something else that I'd like to state about the 1993 Railways Act, which talks about sort of, it's probably the worst thing. Although the Roscoe's ownership of the rolling stock is not very good and divides things up. A number of the train operating companies and the whole of the freight operating companies are owned by different people, many of them outside of the UK. So, for example, the company I used to work for, Arriva, cross country, that's owned by the German railways. And we've got the Chinese involved, we've got the Italians, we've got the Dutch, we've got the French, all taking their cut. And I'll qualify that when I say all taking their cut. A lot of the profits that are made from the poor old passengers through inflated fares are going out of the country. And that's the thing that really sticks in my claw, makes me really angry after all the years I've done. So it really is a millstone round our necks, the 1993 Railways Act. I could also bring things up to date with Grant Shapps Williams report, the Great British Railways, but that actually doesn't change anything. All that does is put a thin veneer, an elastoplast, if you like, a sticking plaster over the whole corrupt, disjointed, fragmented system. And I could go on, but I think that's fairly succinct.
Well, you've given us a pretty good idea of why it's so expensive. I was chatting to Finian Cunningham over in China. He's been he's an Irish journalist who's been travelling on the new Indochina system which the Chinese are putting together for a 500-kilometre journey. He said, "Oh well, it was about €20." Now, I mean, that's the prices here are one of the highest in the world now.
They absolutely are. I've got a graph because I've done a few talks about how our prices just completely outstrip rail fares. Say a good example would be a Bristol to London rail fare, and they're sort of 5-6 times more expensive than a similar journey in anywhere you care to mention in Europe. And I could have bring up a slide for that, but I actually haven't got it handy. But they are that much more expensive.
So we have quite a lot of these franchises are kind of breaking, aren't they? We've got we've just got a short list here. We've got Northern Rail, LNER and Southern. All the franchisees have just had to walk away where the companies have gone bust or whatever. And I think there's another one at the moment which is in the process. They've just had their franchise renewed for, these are the train operating companies, for 6 months up in the north. So maybe Martin Summers, we can bring you in here, because this is something you're always pointing out about privatisation, is it's actually not that difficult to renationalise things. You just have to wait. With the railways, you just look at them and watch the train companies falling apart, and then suddenly the government has to snap them back up again, as it's already done for three of our regions.
Well, that's what happened with the pandemic and so on. The government had to step in and, you know, subsidise what was going on. And of course, railways are subsidised. They've always been subsidised. They were subsidised when they were nationalised. That's because the real cost of running a railway, something like the commuter system into London, is the most expensive. You'd think, because it's packed, it'd make money. But in actual fact, you've got to have a huge infrastructure which is only used twice a day. So that's where the money goes. The intercity stuff is more profitable. But and the freight, well, it just depends. But the point is, other countries treat it as a national resource because you can, if you've got an efficient railway system, that makes your country as a whole or your city as a whole more attractive to people to invest in, and so on and so forth. And of course, in some parts of the world, in Tallinn, in Estonia, in Seattle, in the US, public transport is free. So it's got to be subsidised. Yeah. No private operator is going to take it over. So the whole idea behind the 1993 Act was to bring the profit motive into it, even though, you know, it's not really relevant. And of course, there's more subsidy going now to the privatised railway, which is actually being creamed off by the shareholders. I think it's something like three times more subsidy. That's the thing in my mind. Because they carry on subsidising. They don't mind subsidising as long as they're getting their cut. The taxpayer is picking up the tap. And of course, when something like a pandemic or a war comes along, the government's got to run the railway anyway, which is why it was nationalised in the 40s in the first place.
Look, in the background to all of this are the massive beaching cuts in the 1960s, in 1963. One of the reasons they happened was because the government had said, the Department for Transport and Conservatives had said, that the railways must turn a profit. They must make money for themselves. Now, they had artificially kept fares high, which wasn't low, which was not entirely fair. I think it was the British Transport Commission at the time kept the fares quite low, so it was actually impossible for the railways to turn a profit. So in a way, it was a kind of slam dunk. So I think your job would probably have been easier to coax people, Bernard, onto the railway. Not that it is your job. Your job was to drive a train. But you would have been able to coax more people onto the railway if the network was the sort of size and extent as extensive as it was back in the 1950s and early 60s.
That's right. Beeching was just a massive mistake. It was... the railways weren't... needed the subsidy, as has already been stated. But what they really needed was a continuation of the 1955 modernisation plan, and to bring the railways into the 1960s and 70s and get rid of things like steam. But actually, the decision they took was to employ Beeching to make his reshaping railways report, and it was just a total axeman's charter. Was not soundly researched. It was just done in a very, very small margin. When children were on holiday, the surveys that they did, it was totally unsound the way in which it was carried out. And the savings, I'll just finish on this, the savings that were made were insignificant too, but I'll talk about that in a minute.
Well, one of the interesting, I think, you know, for any nerds who are interested in this sort of thing, there's a book out there, I think it's probably going for quite a lot of money these days on the internet, called The Great Isle of Wight Train Robbery, which is where the figures that have been used to calculate which trains were to be shut down on the Isle of Wight were leaked. And a few people then sort of crunched through the figures and said, well, hang on a minute, you know, you've pretended that there are double the number of level crossings that there are actually in the Isle of Wight. And so you've fixed the figures. You've decided that, you know, you want to have a... And in fact, as a result, a lot of the... they were planning to shut down all the railways in the Isle of Wight, and quite a few were saved at the time because... You know, so there was, I think, in as well with Beeching, a falsification of figures that went on deliberately. Now, the background to all of this, of course, is North Sea Oil and the rise of the car, the building of the motorways, and the Transport Minister, Ernest Marples, was a Conservative. He owned a company called Marples Ridgeway, which was, by coincidence, a road construction firm responsible for, I think it was, the Hammersmith flyover and other large road schemes. So, and he ended up, I looked this up recently, he ended up over in Monaco as a tax exile. He couldn't come back to the country, otherwise he'd have been arrested because he hadn't paid tax properly. But anyway, what do you make of the politics of it? Because the Conservatives most definitely had decided, we want to import more oil, and this is partly one of the reasons why we're in the mess we're in now, and become reliant on the motor car.
That's right, and the vision was that the railways were out of date and needed to be sort of cut back and needed to be rationalised. So they brought in the good doctor, Beeching, to He came from ICI and worked in chemicals, and I understand other things before that, but that's where I came my research came across him first. He had no idea about how a railway works.
He was a metallurgist.
That's right.
So he would probably be quite good at figuring out what metal to use in an actual rail in order to make it last a long time, but not much else.
Exactly, yeah. And so he failed to understand that a railway system, a railway network, is much like a river, and that the branch lines feed the main lines. And if you cut the... if you just take a particular line in isolation and do a survey and get the figures that you're looking for during sort of light use, as it were, then that's going to give you the figures that that you want if your agenda is to close the railways, and that's exactly what happened.
Yeah, so, well, we're in the situation today. What about these strikes? Can you take us through some of the different unions there are on the railways and why they're striking?
Of course, yeah.
So why you're striking?
Yes, well, I'll cover... It's a very similar agenda, but yes, ASLEF have balloted their members. And I've taken three strike days so far, and I think there's going to be others coming up. Although there's a bit of a light on the horizon, as it were, that I understand that the new transport minister is going to be going into talks. But yes, ASLEF, the Train Drivers Union, the RMT, TSSA and Unite, that's all of the rail unions, are completely fed up of being ignored with... pay claims. None of us have had a pay rise since pre-COVID. And at one stage, we were all hailed during the pandemic as key workers. And then as soon as the pandemic has eased off somewhat, we're now greedy and lazy trade unions.
Well, you know what? I think we might have to bring in some new laws to stop you striking. That's what the sort of noises that were coming out of the Tory conference.
That's correct, yes. Well, of course, they're ignoring the fact that it's a basic human right to withdraw your labour, and it's enshrined in the United Nations Charter, I believe. So it'll be interesting to see how they get along with doing that. But I just wanted to go on. Personally, I've just retired. As I mentioned before, I did work all the way through the pandemic, and I was concerned at some stage with sort of going down with COVID. And the fact that I haven't had a pay rise with my colleagues has actually affected my pension as well, and that's made me feel quite angry and bitter. But the other thing to stress, of course, I think most importantly, which the place I should have started at really, is that none of the trade unions, that's all of them I mentioned before, ASLEF, the RMT, TSSA and Unite, want to take this industrial action. We'd like to get round the table, and the two general secretaries who get quite a lot of coverage, my general secretary, Mick Whelan, and everyone has heard of Mick Lynch, the RMT general secretary, want to get round the table and talk and negotiate some deal. And that is possible. But the previous... Transport Minister Grant Shapps was having none of it, and all he did was kick the can down the road, and he wouldn't talk. He wouldn't talk and negotiate with us. But I'm actually quite confident with my experience that if the negotiators, and I used to be a negotiator in the freight sector, can get round the table with the appropriate management negotiators, then this will be very quickly resolved. Not only that, both the ASLEF and RMT have made settlements with other companies. I'll talk particularly about ASLEF. ASLEF have negotiated settlements with some of the freight companies, quite a few freight companies and some passenger companies. So we're not all out on strike. This business about sort of not being able to get round the table and talk and negotiate will not get us anywhere. And I look forward to the time that, like I say, there's a bit of a glow on the horizon, a bit of hope on the horizon that this new Anne-Marie, I can't remember her name, Trevelyan, is it? The new transport minister is going to take a different attitude from Grant Shapps, which I completely welcome.
Well, it's a bit rich, isn't it, for these, say, for example, big oil companies transporting petrol and diesel around the country by train to say, oh, we can't afford to pay the drivers enough. So you are, I suppose, it's a little bit easier for you negotiating with these bigger industries than it is with these sometimes marginal train operating companies. Obviously, we have, oh, there's another one, isn't there, that's just... I think it's called Avanti.
Avanti West Coast, yeah. They've had lots of difficulties covering their trains through mismanagement, and particularly the lies they told the general public about Aslef and drivers not working Sundays, taking industrial action, when actually it's on their company, it's voluntary to work Sundays. That didn't go down
anyway,
very well.
Anyway, politicians in Greater Manchester have been left dismayed after the worse than dreadful Avanti West Coast was given another 6 months to run rail services. The Department of Transport announced on the 7th of October, that's today.
Yes,
it was
today.
giving the under fire operator until April 2023 to turn things round. It comes after direct services between London and Manchester were slashed to 1 hour due to operational difficulties, in inverted commas. I think this is one of those things about the railways that if I'm over on a train and I hear some sort of announcement and then someone says operational difficulties, I always wonder what is actually really going on. Is this a cow on the line, or is it just that maybe you know, you haven't got the staff to drive the train, Bernard?
Well, in Avanti West Coast situation, it was just lies all the way through. Yes, operational difficulties covers a multitude of sins, but I mean, with the Sunday issue on Avanti, it was very clear.
So the following today's announcement, the Mayor of Greater Manchester is urging the government to keep a close eye on Avanti's performance every single day, and the company is still found wanting just over 2 months' time. Burnham believes Avanti should be stripped of the franchise before Christmas. Now, Martin, I mean, this is one of the reasons, isn't it, that the is given that the train operating companies negotiating with Bernard and other union representatives, that they're saying, well, actually, it's very difficult for us to be running a profit anyway. So it's a way, I suppose, of forcing them to try and give us smaller settlements, pay settlements to the unions as possible, because some of them are on the brink of bankruptcy anyway.
Yeah, and of course the whole beaching thing was to get rid of the trade unions in the railways, as well as to get rid of the railways themselves.
There was a big strike, wasn't there, in the 1950s? You know, if the railways are on strike for 3 weeks, suddenly the power stations don't have enough power and things like that. So there was a Tory party conference just after the rail strike, and they were saying, well, we're just going to have to smash the unions by smashing the railways.
Well, they used to talk about the miners, the steel workers, and the railway workers as the triple alliance. And of course, in the general strike, they all came out simultaneously in the 20s. And of course, when the railways were nationalised, you had national pay bargaining. So in actual fact, that meant that you could actually, there was a pressure on the NUR leadership not to push for too high a pay settlement, especially when they're negotiating with Labour governments. But of course, what's happened with the fragmentation, as the former head of the RM2, who's dead now, his name just escapes
me. Bob Crowe,
realised that in actual fact, you've got all these small companies, this is where the skills of railway workers allow them to push their wages up, because they can, because all these small companies, they can't replace train drivers overnight. They couldn't really replace miners, and they certainly, you know, steel workers, you know, but railway workers, because it's, you know, even on low level in the railway, you've got to have people who know what they're doing. You can't have any old body doing it. It just wouldn't work. And that's another reason why you should have an integrated system with trade unions represented possibly on the board of the nationalised industry. Why not? You know, but of course they wanted to get away from all of that in the 50s. And, of course, subsequently, the 1993 Act is further away from it. And, you know, we can't go back because it's too late. There's too many waters passed and there's too many bridges. But I think the ordinary public are beginning to realise that this is not the way to run a railroad. You know, it's symptomatic of everything that's gone wrong in this country, isn't it?
The Avanti West Coast situation that's just cropped up today is very, very interesting, because it's the first time that there's been a problem or a question mark about franchises since the new Great British Railways Grant Shapps Williams organised report has come out. Because what's happened before when a franchise has failed, and clearly Avanti West Coast is a failing franchise, it's been taken back, like the LNER and other franchises, back into public ownership. But of course, if they did that with Avanti, it would immediately indicate that the Grant Shapps Williams Great British Railways has failed very, very quickly. So of course they couldn't do that. Not, I think they only had, I'm not sure about this, but I'd take a very good calculated guess that they only had one option to give them another 6 months or so, because there's no one else that could take the franchise over.
So train firms must compromise over strikes. This is 2 days ago at the Tory conference, says the new transport secretary. The new transport secretary said that train companies must be prepared to make compromises to bring an end to strikes that have crippled the network. Anne-Marie Trevelyan told BBC News all sides had a voice in this dispute. Well, this is almost a kind of new, this is what you were saying just now, a new kind of angle.
It's a ray of hope.
Saying this, yeah. Now, what Mick Lynch had been saying from the RMT was that even though the unions were directly negotiating with the train operating companies, and I think Railtrack as well, that actually that they had been going out of the room and making phone calls to the Department for Transport. So actually what's happening is the Department for Transport is negotiating with the unions secretly from behind the scenes.
When they get to a certain stage in the negotiations, yes, they were thinking they've got a deal and a proposed paper for, say, a pay deal. Normally, that would go to the board of the particular franchise. At the same time, it would also be briefed out to the membership of the trade union to see if it would be acceptable. And then, obviously, it would then be voted on once it was cleared by the board. But now, of course, we've got the extra barrier, hurdle of the DfT getting involved, who haven't got a clue. Well, certainly Grant Shapps hadn't got any clue.
Now, it looks as if these strikes, which we began, I think it was in June, with the RMT rail strike, are widening. So we've also got the communication workers, the post office workers, going on strike now with rolling strikes every week or every few weeks. And just looking at this week, we've got the Royal College of Nursing, the first ever UK-wide ballot for striking, as well as the midwives are also balloting. I mean, the idea of having no midwives, if a woman is giving birth and she phones up to say, I'm about to give birth, can you send an ambulance? They say, sorry, we haven't got any midwives. This is where we seem to be heading with all this, Martin.
Well, if we didn't have the Tory trade union legislation from the 80s on the books, what happened in South Wales in the early 80s was that the miners went on strike to force a wage increase for nurses. And that's what you do. Because that's the whole, and in other countries, it's perfectly legal for trade unions to do this.
Talking about miners, right? If you go back to the miners' strike in the 1980s, it was quite clear that the government had a strategy. They wanted a strike so that they could smash the union. Now, it may be that Truss and Kwarteng and Boris before them are actually quite relishing the idea of strikes. They believe that through these strikes, they can smash these unions to pieces.
Well, that's a delusion. Is all I'll say.
Bernard, what do you think?
I agree, it's a complete delusion, and if that is the case, they've completely got it wrong. Up and down the country, at the on the picket lines, there's been massive support for the rail strikes. In Bristol last weekend, 2,000 people met nearby the Temple Meads picket line for the Enough is Enough campaign, and then they all went off to OVO to protest about the fuel situation, and then all 2,000 of them came back to the picket line and blocked Temple Way. It was actually staggering, the support, and they were just ordinary people who aren't very good at doing star jumps or aren't very good at sort of the ridiculous advice that we get from the government about the cost of living and fuel increases. So going on to the news that the first time ever the Royal College of Nursing as balloting its 300,000 members. That's quite a that's quite a thing, and I hope they get a good yes vote.
Honestly, I mean, one of the most, I don't know, you probably know this as a branch secretary, but one of the best things to get people through the door is when you start talking about pensions. And once people see their pensions being eroded, they do get very animated quite naturally. We've seen the new government with its mini budget actually starting to make these pension funds even nervous, so that, I mean, that could potentially threaten people's pensions into the decades to come, like you have just retired.
Well, certainly it could, and with the initial news that of that fiscal budget announcement, the Bank of England had to step in because they were concerned about these pension funds.
Yes, I rather loved it when the Bank of England this week, and maybe I'll put this, if I can find it, I'll put the little graph up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, where Liz Truss and the Tory leadership were saying, oh, it was an international crisis, it was nothing to do with us. Well, the Bank of England then promptly published and said, well, look, this is what we had to do. This is all the quantitative easing with money we had to create and spend and buy up government bonds in order to stop the pound from crashing. So it quite clearly was them. It wasn't the international crisis. It was nothing to do with Putin causing this. This was them. Let's just take a look now at the party conferences. We had Labour last week. We didn't actually have a clip from the Labour Party conference, but I think we really ought to do that. So let's have a listen now to the Labour leader, Keir Starmer, in his conference speech, where, and we'll be getting into a bit more of this later, we've got the sort of factionalism going on within the Labour Party, where you've had the old Labour left under Corbyn and this new Labour right, which is very much the sort of Blairite version of the Labour Party. Is your union and the RMT, are they affiliated to the Labour Party still?
ASLEF is still affiliated to the Labour Party. The RMT hasn't been affiliated to the Labour Party for some years now. I think back in the 80s, they disaffiliated. I'm not sure about that.
And so these are basically democratic decisions made at your conferences, as I understand it.
That's correct. In fact, ASLEF at their 2022 conference in Bournemouth debated whether to disaffiliate from the Labour Party, and it was quite a heated debate.
I bet it was good. Was it a card vote? Was it?
No. it was electronic now, yeah. And it did get knocked back, so ASLEF has remained affiliated to the Labour Party.
Maybe the Labour Party had control of your electronic voting system and they managed to do it that way. But anyhow.
Well, I hope not, but it's well, interesting you just, thought.
This is, I mean, we do discuss this from time to time on this programme about the various voting systems and how reliable they are. But anyway, back to the Labour conference from last week, and this is where Keir Starmer says that, and he's really just still having a go at the old Corbyn leadership, which does seem to be, you know, playing to the gallery of the right wing of his party and to big business listening, saying that he thinks that the Labour Party deserved to lose the election back in 2019.
My vision for Britain is simple. I want this be the best country to grow up in and the best country to grow old in. A country in which we put family first. A country that embodies the values I hold dear. Decency, fairness, opportunity, compassion and security. I've tried to be constructive. I appreciate that these are unprecedented times and that governing is hard. I've tried to be fair, to give the government the benefit of the doubt. But now, with one of the highest death rates in the world, on the threshold of one of the deepest recessions anywhere, I'm afraid there is no doubt. This government's incompetence is holding Britain back. So let's be blunt. Let's be brutally honest with ourselves. When you lose an election in a democracy, you deserve to. You don't look at the electorate and ask them, what were you thinking?
Yes, yeah, so that was Keir Starmer speaking last week. And I mean, it's a little bit rich for him to be saying this sort of thing, Martin, isn't it? Because we know that there was a tremendous amount of effort going on within the Labour Party itself. Obviously, you know, you've got the right-wing London press to cope with as one obstacle to real democracy. So, in other words, the voters are actually finding out what the parties believe and not having to put up with character assassinations of anybody who's, you know, trade unionist or left-wing. But also within the party itself, which is one of the most disturbing things, that there were... should we call them Starmerites or Blairites within the Labour Party who were trying to undermine Corbyn at every step?
Well, that's pretty clear from the Al Jazeera documentaries that have been coming out, but we pretty much knew this anyway. The full-time officials were sabotaging the electoral efforts of people like myself.
Did Labour deserve to lose?
I'm coming on to that. In actual fact, under First Past the Post, they didn't lose by very much. If they've just got a few thousand votes more, they'd have been over the line. Now, that's a problem because the system is wrong. We've got a government with a majority of 80 that got 43% of the vote. That wouldn't cut any ice in Ireland,
Denmark, Norway,
Denmark,
Martin, Sweden, any of those
Martin, countries.
Martin, in 2017, it was even closer, wasn't it? With the DUP holding the balance
of power. That's right. Now, I think from my point of view, the Labour Party should have committed to proportional representation as the New Zealand Labour Party did in the 1980s against their own right-wing government.
As they've now done, I believe.
Well, they did it in the 80s, the Labour Party came to power in New Zealand, but they carried out Thatcherite policy. So the grassroots of the party, one of the things that really was a red rag to the Labour Party grassroots, was the privatisation of the New Zealand Railway. And it's only a tiny railway. Right. But they privatised it and they said, we don't have to do this. Why are we doing it? And they suddenly realised what the game is under First Past the Post in New Zealand is we vote for a left-wing Labour government and they do exactly what we don't want them to do. And they got it immediately and they said, right, we're going to have to change the electoral system. That's only a small country. So they just went and knocked on every door and got a petition up and then they forced a referendum on PR and won it. And of course, they're now become the party of government in New Zealand. But they didn't have to bring the Greens, for example, into the government this last time, but they did because they thought, well, we might as well have them on board. But they'd actually won outright more than 50% of the vote. And that's because of the way in which the system works. It's like when it was in the 1980s that the New Zealand rugby union team was showing British rugby union teams how to play rugby. And the New Zealand Labour Party were trying to show us how to play things as well.
We got quite a lot of catching up to do to win the tournament, I think. But anyway, look, just let's get right into this. It's called the Labour Files. There are four editions of it, all of them around about an hour long that Al Jazeera has been transmitting over the last few weeks are doing an absolutely brilliant. I mean, it's just like watching, say, a World in Action from the 1980s or a Panorama from the 1980s, when the days when British documentaries and the British networks used to do really hard-hitting investigative journalism. And here we're going to have two clips from this program called The Hierarchy, which is the third in the series. And this one looks at specifically at racism in the Labour Party, in the modern Starmer Labour Party, and also how it was actually there in the Corbyn Labour Party, behind Corbyn's back. He didn't want this to be happening at all, but to a certain extent it was. But particularly how it's accelerated now Starmer has actually taken over. And it really is quite surprising to see. I mean, listening and looking at this, it looks actually more specifically racist, literally, against Asians and particularly against West Indians than even the Conservative Party, which is incredible within the Labour Party. Let's have a listen to this clip now. First of all, looking at what was going on in Newham under Labour, where lots and lots of Asians had joined the Labour Party in Newham under Corbyn, and yet found that they were completely blocked by the Newham Labour Party people who'd been councillors for many years and saw all these new members as a threat. And then we go on to look at what was going on at Colston after this. But let's start off by looking at Newham.
Welcome, Jeremy Corbyn! Jeremy!
Suddenly all these people are thinking, oh, I'm going to join the Labour Party. We've got Jeremy Corbyn. There are ideas now. We can talk about freedom and equality and good social services and a proper national health service.
But not everyone in the party welcomes the new members.
We are a borough which is 100% Labour borough. but there wasn't enough representation of the Muslim community, especially Pakistani community. All the Labour Party leaders was from the white members of the community.
Pre-2016, the Labour Party was quite small in Newham, and meetings were even smaller. So people had positions. I think it became, for many of them, like a social club.
A factional battle breaks out, based on racial lines. A regional party organiser, Carl Morris, complains about Muslim community leaders. Morris and Amy Fode have been concerned about South Asian members.
Amy and I were alerted to a gathering of predominantly Asian men on the pavement.
Several Asian party members are congregating, waiting to attend the party's annual general meeting.
Carl states that he was alerted to a group of Pakistani men. So Amy Fode decided to take a photo of these individuals. I felt that that was completely inappropriate.
Morris's complaint continues.
The events on Thursday validate earlier information about a coordinated attempt to infiltrate in Newham by the Pakistani community. This is a toxic combination, and it makes an early freeze date for the selection process of local council candidates for the 2018 municipal elections essential.
It was quite clear to me that there was something insidious going on. Carl Morris states explicitly that he fears Newham is being infiltrated by a number of Pakistani men. Something that I saw as clear-cut Islamophobia. The word infiltrate is quite a loaded term, especially when you're talking about a group of Muslims who are trying to engage within politics.
It's shocking to use the word infiltrate. It's othering, it's putting people outside of the mainstream. It's very symptomatic that somebody who's working full-time for the Labour Party would see people who wanted to join as infiltrators. I think that's quite disgraceful and says a huge amount about their level of consciousness around race.
A councillor, Obaid Khan, is suspended from the party. Local community groups send a letter to Robin Wales, Newham's mayor.
We wish to express our dissatisfaction, anger, and disappointment at the treatment of a leading figure in the Muslim community, Councillor Obaid Khan. We believe you have contrived and manipulated the party processes to get him unfairly expelled with trumped up and false accusations against him.
Mayor Wales passes the letter to John Stolliday, the head of the party's legal and governance unit.
The mayor of Newham at that time then sent an email across to John Stolliday stating that the contents were libelous in form and seeking advice on what action he can take against the members.
Stolliday writes back to Mayor Wales.
I'm sorry you have been subject of such horrible lies and smears. As for disciplinary action against those individuals, I agree that we need to protect you. If you have any more evidence that we can tie to individuals, then do send it through.
Instead of questioning the mayor at that time and in regards to why the members were claiming racial discrimination, John Stolliday decided to agree with the mayor and say that these accusations are libelous, and decided to take action against the individuals that had raised the complaints.
Now, I know we covered this at the time, Martin, didn't we? The shenanigans going on within the Labour Party in Newham. But it's incredibly shocking that as people join the party, they see an all-white bunch of councillors there. These Pakistanis quite rightly thinking, well, it'd be great, let's get a Pakistani councillor here. And they're accused of infiltrating the party. And actually, many of them suspended, including one of the councillors themselves.
Yeah, and of course this is Al Jazeera who are doing this show, and of course that's run by the government of Qatar. So, you know, the kind of people who watch Al Jazeera around the world are, you know, many of them Muslims. So obviously this is something that matters to them quite a lot.
Of course, but it matters to me as well, that the Labour Party
is Muslims who are concerned
creating,
about this.
Well, that's right, it's creating a hostile environment for Pakistanis, Bernard, which is amazing.
Yes, I watched, I think, the first three of the Al Jazeera investigations programme. I didn't actually see the one that you've just played, so that was quite interesting. But I was shocked and devastated. I was in the Labour Party. I haven't renewed my subscriptions, and I don't intend doing it for other reasons. But the programmes I've seen so far and the clip you've just played just reinforces my feeling of relief of what I've done. I was totally shocked about the features in the first three programmes. There's too numerous to mention sort of here today, but I did want to pull up about the BBC Panorama programme about anti-Semitism, which was pulled apart by investigations. And I thought at the time when I was watching it how horrible what was going on, the anti-Semitism and those party workers, but something didn't ring true. Anyway, obviously, I think it was the second or third of these programmes they were pulled apart, and their evidence was given proper scrutiny and completely dismissed, I believe. That's what I felt. Can I just say one other thing? Whilst I was a member of the Labour Party, I was active in my previous. I used to live in St. Werburgh's, in a part of Ashley Ward. I was the trade union liaison officer for a number of years there. Before I left, and COVID had kicked in by this time, there was an annual general meeting of Bristol West, which was done on Zoom. And now these Zoom meetings happen sort of all over the country because of the pandemic. But all of the slate, if you weren't on the particular Starmer sort of slate, you were knocked off, and I couldn't believe what happened.
I was there.
In Bristol.
I was on the same Zoom meeting as you were.
So I wasn't. I did get it right, didn't I?
No,
I couldn't believe what I was seeing. Sorry.
Well, I mean, I'm just reinforcing what you're saying, because I was there. I got on. The meeting was supposed to be at 7 o'clock.
That's right.
And we were still there at midnight,
yes,
having our votes registered or not registered. And then, of course, they then told us that the left couldn't possibly have won the election, which seems absurd if you think about the Bristol West Labour Party, one of the biggest in the country. Loads of people joined during the Corbyn era. Why would the right win that election?
Looking at your computer screen, sort of, there was no, that they'd knocked off any left-wing candidates or other candidates apart from the slate. Lots of people couldn't even get on.
That's right. The whole thing.
I was lucky to get on. I think you were too.
Yeah.
I'd say you were too.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, I mean, all of these manipulations, I mean, to be honest with you, they've been going on forever. They've got more serious, yeah, but there's always been. The Labour Party is a strange beast, because it's part of the establishment, and it's also got people in it who are not part of the establishment, and so it's always constantly broiling inside itself about this. And, of course, in other countries, it's quite straightforward. There is a mainstream social democrat party, and then there is a more left-wing party that you can be a part of, and they have people elected too.
Yeah.
And, of course, often what the mainstream social democrats have to do, they have to bring the left in on to discuss things, because otherwise they can't form a government.
Well, I don't think this is the only country where these sort of digital electoral fraud things go on at all. But anyway, look, we're going to have a listen now to another clip from the Labour files, Al Jazeera, The Hierarchy Now. And this one touches on Black Lives Matter. So this is more looking at the West Indian racism within the Labour Party, and includes a look at what happened here in Bristol with the Edward Colston statue and how Keir Starmer reacted to it.
The Labour files include recordings of a video call between Sir Keir Starmer and Black and Asian staff. Starmer had described the Black Lives Matter movement as a moment.
There's a broader issue here, the Black Lives Matter movement, or moment, if you like, internationally.
It's for me to explain what I meant when I said moment. I'm clear what I meant. Some people thought I meant fleeting moment. I honestly don't see that it's possible to read that into what I actually said.
Keir Starmer is a lawyer. He chooses his words carefully. And when he described Black Lives Matter as a moment, it was very telling.
The leadership's attitude to Black Lives Matter was incredibly hostile. The first thing that the leadership wanted to do was to appear on media and delegitimise the activists and also distance themselves from the policy agenda that they were promoting.
Black and Asian staff write a memo to Starmer and Deputy Leader Angela Rayner. For black members of staff, we need to be listened to. We expect the manifestation of our trauma to be understood. Instead, the top line briefed was that Keir Starmer, leader of the Labour Party, condemns the completely wrong tearing down of the statue of slave trader Edward Colston in Bristol at the weekend.
I see Keir Starmer as a man who has absolutely no political integrity. It's like, what do I need to say? We've taken the temperature that everybody in this country is against the Colston statue being dropped. So therefore, it doesn't matter whether I think it's right or wrong, I need to take a position that it's wrong because that was what will get me elected.
2 days after the BAME Group's letter to Starmer and Rayner, the party drafts a strategy to regain black support. All but one of the team writing the report, called the Black Engagement Plan, is white. Ellie Robinson, Keir Starmer's deputy political director, emails.
This morning, there was a discussion about BLM. I took an action to write up a plan for our work in this area going forward. I think our lines to the black community are in a good place.
Halima Khan is chair of the BAME staff network at the time.
The Black Community Engagement Plan. I have never seen this before. I'm not surprised that this would have come to the BAME staff. I don't think we would have taken it well, especially when Black Lives Matter is referred to as a culture war.
I think the framing of the document very much shows like the anxiety of the leadership when it comes to these issues that are part of the culture, they are terrified of being seen as acting on issues of diversity, inclusion, and because it might alienate some people who they perceive to be their key voters.
Sort of suggests that there's a battle for the bottom, battle for the sewer between the Tories and Labour now for sort of bigoted white votes. Suggests that the Labour Party's lost its way. Al Jazeera's Labour files actually corroborate that there is something rather ill, troubling, frightening about the Labour Party.
The British Muslim has to think twice now, because Labour is not a safe haven for them as we was thinking in the past, and the Labour is maybe not the place you're thinking that you're supposed to be in.
What the Labour Party took from me was a sense of believing that I could be a part of something bigger than me and advocate for change and, you know, a better world.
What happened to me was enough to make me step down. It's reeks of a culture where anti-black racism is not only accepted, not only tolerated, but actively promoted.
So in each of these programs from Al Jazeera, that one is one of four, I think it's four, and So they are the Labour files. That one was called The Hierarchy. That's part three of the series. But this it's completely against everything the Labour Party is supposed to stand for, Martin. The idea that, for example, an inquiry within the party into potential anti-black racism within the party is almost completely white people writing that report, and so many of these people have felt that they've been completely marginalised by this within the West Indian community. So what's happened is Corbyn has brought all these people in. Starmer is now driving them out.
Well, this is clearly the sort of the lie of the land that we're talking about here. Let's put ourselves in the mindset of the right wing of the Labour Party, because they see themselves, you know, they have a view. And as you know, we sometimes have them on this show, and they're often the most difficult people to deal with. Tories easier in some respects. They think that the opinion poll lead that they've got now will allow them to win a first past the post election. And therefore, the end justifies the means. So Rachel Reeves, the shadow chancellor in Liverpool, was saying, well, we can't renationalise the railways because of the pandemic, we've got no money. Totally ridiculous.
Well, I think they've changed. Haven't they changed their tune now? I think they said something about the Labour Party are happy to renationalise.
But that's because that's reality. The Tories are kind of maybe have to face up to that as well. Yeah, I mean, that's why you are going to get a deal out of this new Tory transport secretary, because they can't win. They're in a corner, especially if the people in the rail union stick to their guns. It's going to be very difficult for them to beat.
I suppose the main thing to ask Bernard here about all this, I mean, you know, the black anti-West Indian, anti-black racism aside, is, you know, the lack of support there's been from the Labour Party. Now, this isn't just going to affect key workers and public sector workers' pay. It's also affecting now those on benefits. So they're now saying that we won't even, you know, never mind wages, we're not going to let benefits rise up with inflation. So inflation is also almost becoming a tool to hit everybody except for the upper middle class and the super rich.
Absolutely. I mean, if you listen to Liz Truss's speech, it's all those people that she listed, and I'm proud to be one of those. But going back to what we were talking about regarding the Al Jazeera programme and the Keir Starmer's opinion about the Colston statue, I've fought against racism all my adult life, and that started off with in the late 70s with Rock Against Racism when I was a very young man, a teenager, and there was a campaign, certainly, through the proper channels, as it were, or channels, shall we say, anyway, to get rid of the Colston statue, because most people in Bristol didn't want it. And it got blocked, and there was also lots of compromise going on in terms of, sort of, oh, we'll put a plaque up, this, that and the other. Now, I know there was plenty of opposition to it being pulled down, but personally speaking, I was really pleased to see it go.
This wasn't some fly-by-night campaign. No, it had been going on for decades.
Absolutely, absolutely decades. I felt embarrassed either walking or cycling or driving through the centre to see that statue of that man there. So I was particularly pleased to see it go. And I can remember exactly where I was. I remember there was going to be a demonstration that day from the Black Lives Matter. Obviously, it's going on about the American victim who I can't remember his name now.
Floyd.
But that's it. Thank you, Floyd. And I was on my way to work, actually. And I remember thinking, and I heard lots of cheering going on, sort of, as I was coming through Old Market, heading down to Temple Meads, thinking, you know, I'd like to be there. And then I saw on the news later on, of course, that the statue had been, you know, pulled down. But then again, you know, they charged four people with that act of tearing it down, and then were found not guilty. Now, I know that wasn't everybody's opinion, but I thought you know, the justice was done there, personally speaking. We haven't got enough time to go into all of the things that Al Jazeera has exposed in talking about racism in the Labour Party, but it is particularly disturbing. You know, the supports for Zionist groups and who have got links to EDL, that Al Jazeera Labour investigations exposed. That probably shocked me the most out of these three programmes.
Well, it's pretty clear the Labour Party clamps down immediately on anybody who seems to be supporting Palestine.
Yes,
anyway, we do. You're right, we have to crack on. And let's have a listen now to the wonderful Liz Truss, our great new Prime Minister's speech. Yeah, afraid so, Bernard. And and we're going to hear here where Greenpeace interrupt her in full flow.
I want to live in a country where hard work's rewarded, where women can walk home safely at night, and where our children have a better future. To deliver this, we need to get Britain moving. We cannot have any more drift and delay at this vital time. Let's remember where we were when I entered Downing Street. Average energy bills were predicted to soar above £6,000 a year. We faced the highest tax burden that our country had had for 70 years. And we were told that we could do nothing about it. I didn't accept that things had to be that way. I knew that inaction would be unconscionable. Families would have been unable to heat their homes. Businesses would have gone bust. Jobs would have been lost. And we would have worse public services, including the NHS. I couldn't allow this to happen. I refused to consign our great country to decline. And that's why I promised on entering Downing Street to act.
Actually, there's quite a long interruption. I cut about half a minute out here, but these Greenpeace people, wonderful folk, complaining about fracking particularly, but they've intervened there just as the Prime Minister is talking about these enormous subsidies now between £100 and £200 billion going to the energy companies, Bernard.
Yeah, it's absolutely disgusting, and they don't know the real knock-on effect on the environment and everything else through fracking. They seem to be completely paranoid because of the current energy crisis. They've got to look at everything. And the only thing they've got in response is when anybody like Greenpeace or even their own members raise concern about fracking is, oh, well, we'll have a vote, or, you know, we won't do it locally if it's against public opinion. And in my opinion, that's, you know, not to be trusted. I mean, it's a ridiculous road to go down. I thought we got rid of it, but sadly it's back with us.
Well, there was all sorts of terrible phrases like this, growth. I mean, she's trying to desperately mimic Thatcher, but she's just not up to the job. Anyway, we're going to hear now a clip where she talks about Scotland and Wales and how belligerent they're being.
Mark Drakeford in Wales is cancelling road building projects and refusing to build the M4 relief road. Nicola Sturgeon won't build new nuclear power stations to solve the energy crisis in Scotland. Have these people ever seen a tax rise they don't like? or an industry they don't want to control? They don't understand the British people. They don't understand aspiration. They are prepared to leave our towns and cities facing decline. My friends, does the anti-growth coalition have any idea who pays their wages? The people who make things in factories across our country. It's the people who get up at the crack of dawn to go to work. It's the commuters who get trains into towns and cities across our country. I'm thinking of the white van drivers, the hairdressers, the plumbers, the accountants, the IT workers, and millions of others up and down the UK. The anti-growth coalition just doesn't get it. It's because they don't face the same challenges as normal working people. These enemies of enterprise don't know the frustration you feel to see your road blocked by protesters or your trains off due to a strike. In fact, their friends on the hard left tend to be the ones behind the disruption. The anti-growth coalition think that people who stick themselves to trains, roads and buildings are heroes. I say the real heroes are the people who go out to work, take responsibility and aspire to a better life for themselves and their families. And I am on their side. We will build roads, rail, energy and broadband quicker. We will be proudly pro-growth, pro-aspiration and pro-enterprise. That is how we will forge ahead on our long-term path to national success. In this new era, we're taking a new approach. My friends, we're focused on boosting growth and opportunity across our country. This mission will be difficult, but it is necessary. We have no alternative if we want to get our economy moving again. I'm ready to make the hard choices. You can trust me to do what it takes. The status quo is not an option. That is why we can't give in to the voices of decline. We can't give in to those who say Britain can't go faster. We can't give in to those who say we can't do better. We must stay the course. We are the only party with a clear plan to get Britain moving. We are the only party with the determination to deliver. Together, we can unleash the full potential of our great country. That is how we will build a new Britain for a new era.
So there she is with a great crescendo at the end there. She's having a pop at people like you. She says, Bernard, she says, you're a part of something called the Anti-Growth Coalition. And I suppose that growth, what does it mean? It means share price growth for those with big share portfolios.
Well, it also means that their whole wherewithal, their whole portfolio relies on growth. And it cannot survive and it cannot flourish without growth. I found it particularly sickening to hear the way she described, although in some respects I was quite proud to be lumped in with all the other people that she mentioned in the anti-growth coalition. Interestingly enough, yesterday on Radio 5 in the morning, Chris Packham spoke, and he directly attacked the speech and the growth effort of the speech. And he also talked about how we've only got one Earth and we need to be careful about how we're using it, etc. So it was completely... I found myself... I don't always agree with Chris Packham, but I found myself thinking, yeah, that's the way... that's the direction we need to be headed in and not... but she's just another, she was trying to imitate Thatcher. She's trying to imitate people like Tony Blair. But I don't, but behind those empty phrases, I don't think there's very much.
No, it looks, she looks more like Beaker from The Muppets, actually. If you have a look at, you do a internet search for Beaker from The Muppets and then bring up the images, there is Liz Truss. There she is.
If you look at the front of yesterday's Guardian, and it talks about getting Britain moving, etc. My wife said there should have been a caption under there called Laxative Liz.
Well, that's right. She is a bit, yeah. Almost a figure of fun. Well, if it wasn't so serious, it would be fun. Even Martin Summers, even Martin Wolf in the Financial Times, and also copied in Tuesday's iPaper, his headline is, "These people are mad, bad and dangerous. They have to go." I mean, he's a FT columnist. Yeah. He's also a Bilderberger, by the way, or was. Liz Truss has been weighed in the balance and found wanting, he says. So too has Kwasi Kwarteng. A week of unnecessary and damaging turmoil proved this. But behind it is an even bigger danger. The only sort of leader more dangerous than the rogue the UK used to have is the zealot it has now. And this is what he I mean, it's a brilliant photo here that the iPaper use, which is "End the Cost of Greed Crisis." And he winds the article up. I'll put a copy of it up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. So it's a terrific bit of journalism, actually. I don't often say that about the East London media. Truss and Kwarteng will not deliver this. Unfunded tax cuts and investment zones will certainly not deliver this. And he's using her deliver, deliver, deliver thing. Another big jump in inequality will not deliver this. These people are mad, bad and dangerous. They have to go.
Well, that's Martin Wolf, who's, you know, a journalist on the Financial Times. As you know, in actual fact, the Financial Times employs journalists who are not necessarily Thatcherites, and Wolf isn't.
Well, he's basically almost like the voice of the markets here. Well, he's saying they don't know what they're doing.
Well, I mean, there's somebody in the markets, I can't remember who, who's a hedge fund manager, saying that the Tories look like a doomsday cult. Let's just pick up for a moment.
And he's also saying in there that that what they say has completely lost touch with reality. So they're trying to impose a version of reality on the financial system which doesn't exist.
Let's come back to this thing of growth. There are loads of questions about what is growth and do we need it and all the rest of it. Those are wider questions. Even in the short run, I think we need better quality growth, but we don't need the economy to stop changing, which is what growth actually is. And the point about the policy they're pursuing is that it won't deliver growth. They are about to put a squeeze on incomes and investment, which will crash the economy, which is exactly why the Forex markets are selling the pound. During the austerity era, the government was supposedly trying to protect the AAA credit rating of Britain, and that's why we had to have austerity. And as a result of Osborne's cuts to public services, they lost the country's AAA credit rating because the economy started to go down, tax receipts went down, and the budget deficit went up. And in other words, you cannot cut your way to prosperity. We knew this 50 years ago. And Thatcherism is the delusion that you can cut your way to prosperity. In actual fact, the way to prosperity is public investment.
Yeah.
And countries who carry out public investment, like in China, just for example, are going to win.
Well, we're going to be hearing a bit more about they are winning. Actually,
yes, they are winning.
They have won.
Well, what's going to happen very, very soon is that the policies they're pursuing, especially if they do try to cut public expenditure rather than unfunding the tax cuts, is that the Bank of England will have to raise interest rates and the economy will crash.
I think this idea,
and it could be that the British economy will crash first and hardest.
Yes, well,
because
we
still haven't recovered to the same level of GDP
COVID.
All of the G7 countries
have. They do seem to be particularly inept. In fact, even seem to enjoy the chaos they create amazingly. But I think one thing, a really important thing to point out about this whole idea of tax cuts for the super rich is that once the super rich get their money, I mean, we're talking here about people who get, you know, £150,000-£500,000 a year in income, is the only part of their wealth that the Inland Revenue can tax is the money as it's paid to them. That is to say, their income. The rest of it, as soon as they get it, they send it offshore to these various tax havens and stuff, and then the government can't get its hands on it anymore, and it's untaxed from that point on. So the only bit that gets taxed is the income. And this is the bit that Kwasi Kwarteng was saying, let's just stop taxing that. So that means the super rich don't get any tax at all. In fact, I'm reminded of good old Kevin Cahill on his Sunday Times days. I remember him saying on this show years ago that one of his most satisfying headlines ever, which was a front page lead on the Sunday Times, was "The Rich Pay No Tax." And also, I mean, Liz Truss may be, her sell-by date is already gone. I don't know how long she's going to last. We shall see. Certainly her credibility is shot, as Martin Wolf points out, absolutely completely gone. unless you're trying to talk her up or sort of, you know, do a marketing campaign for her. But it's always interesting to see who it is that the broadcasters pick up and use immediately after the speech finishes. Because, for example, in the Theresa May era, it was often Boris Johnson who would come on straight away and say, oh, I think that was a wonderful speech, blah, blah. Who was it this time? And this is the person that may be the next Tory leader.
It's a pretty divided party right now. Did she do enough?
I don't think we are divided. I think the support for that speech was overwhelming. She set out clear Conservative policies. She is pro-growth. We have helped people with their energy bills. We have shown that we are a tax-cutting government that believes people spend their own money better than the state spends it for them. This was a really proper Conservative speech, which will be very unifying.
She said the party's at its best when it works together. I mean, it's not working together. You cannot say this week has gone to plan, has it?
Well, we're clearly working on a plan for growth for the economy. What does that mean? That means that people's money goes further, that it's easier for them to buy the goods that they need, that their pay will go up, that, and it will because of the cut in national insurance and the cut in income tax. People have more money in their pockets, they will have a better standard of living. That's what it's all about. As Disraeli used to put it some time ago, it's about improving the condition of the people. That's what the Conservative governments have always hoped to do.
Reports this morning that you want to see benefits rise in line with inflation. That is at odds with the hints coming from Number 10. Are you at odds with the Prime Minister?
I'm never at odds with the Prime Minister, either this one or the previous one. As far as I'm aware, the decision hasn't been made. And there is a legal process. A statutory instrument has to be laid. I think the Secretary of State for Work and Pensions has certain authority in this area. But governments discuss decisions before they're made, and then they get made, and then they get supported. That's the normal process of government.
Okay, what's the PM going to do now to heal divisions with the backbenchers? It's pretty clear that people are angry, that that is something she needs to do.
Well, I'm not sure it is that clear that people are angry. There are always some moaning minis. Look, I used to do this at party conferences and go round and say that I think things should be done differently when I was on the backbenches. That's what backbenchers do.
So you don't think she needs to do anything to heal divisions on the backbenches?
What we need is exactly what she set out, good Conservative policies, and that's what she's offering. And look at the response she got. Absolutely brilliant.
And can I ask, did she steal a line from Keir Starmer? There's some reports that she said growth, those are three priorities. Is that something that Keir Starmer said a couple of years ago in a speech?
Oh, Lord, well, I haven't studied Sir Keir's speeches carefully enough. This has been most remiss of me to work out every phrase that he has ever used.
So the Conservative Party spin doctors chose Jacob Rees-Mogg to be the one who would speak to, I think that was Sky News rather than the BBC, as soon as Liz Truss had finished her, as David Halpin calls her, the damnable Truss, had finished her speech at a Tory party conference this week. And I'm joined on the line, I hope now, by Henry Widdes, who's the chairman of the Northwest Lancashire branch, Henry?
Yes, if you can hear me,
I can hear you fine.
It's the Northwest Lancashire branch of the National Union of Journalists. I'm the chairman.
Okay.
And I'm also like a union rep at work, and I've been like a reporter and sub editor for about 20 years in the local newspaper.
Okay,
industry.
Well, I think it'd be interesting for you and Bernard to compare notes, both as trade unionists, about what exactly this government is up to, because it does look as if we are this winter. I mean, we're hearing this week, aren't we, about we're potentially running out of gas. Isn't that funny? And apparently, it's all due to Vladimir Putin. Only thing is, the pipelines which brought all this gas in, the Nord Stream pipeline, seem to have been blown up. And I don't think it was Russia. I mean, I could not believe hearing the BBC saying, oh, well, the Russians have blown up their own pipelines. I suppose if there's a nuclear bomb goes off in Moscow, then the BBC will be saying, oh, the Russians probably did it to try and blame us for it. So anyway, Henry, give us your take on the general thing to do with cost of living at the moment, because it does look as if we're heading for a battle between the unions, all sorts of unions, nurses, train drivers, firefighters, teachers, over this winter with the government, and possibly we won't be able to cook our poached eggs in the morning because we won't have any gas to cook on.
Well, yeah, just to briefly touch on the Nord pipeline, a few sort of pundits away from mainstream news media have been saying that what benefits would the Russians have from doing that to their own infrastructure?
Well, I mean, we played the clip last week with Joe Biden threatening to do it, basically, back in February. So,
just moving back to the cost of living, I mean, our union members obviously are very concerned, and especially so that so many of us work from home now across different newspaper groups. So we are entitled to a £26 a month working from home allowance from the governments that we have to sort of claim through our so our benefit system at work. But there are sort of moves to try and encourage one of the newspaper groups to work for, to encourage the government to increase that amount, in light of the expected increases.
Well, I mean, our local newspaper here, the Bristol Post, is part of Reach PLC, and I understand there's been a bit of a union dispute with them. I wonder how that's going.
Oh, yeah, well, I mean, just for Hold the Front Page, this week reported they've actually dug their heels in, and the NUJ chapels there have managed to secure up to like £11,000 pay rises for some people.
What?
Well,
they must have been on next to nothing.
I think these are people who are possibly doing management-type roles and weren't sort of being credited for them. But apparently, the report says that between 14% and 40%, for many of the staff, they've had increases between 14% and 44%, which is ginormous. But I think that the standard amounts are going to be it's going to be somewhere between 3% and 4%, I think. But to give us an example of someone who's qualified with their NCTJ diploma, but is still a trainee, rather than being on 20,500, they're going to be on 23,000. 500. That's for journalists outside of London.
Yeah, but the temptation, Henry, must be to leave journalism, because many journalists can make far more, maybe four times, even five times more, working in marketing and for the private sector, basically selling stuff, marketing or PR.
Yeah, that can be true. I've got former colleagues who are, a lot significantly more money than I am by going into PR, but I don't know any of them who says to me they enjoy their job, so... I pretty much enjoy my job all the time. So there's job satisfaction that comes with, slightly less pay perhaps, but it's still, I think as we said last time, I see, the mainstream media as the fourth state, and perhaps we don't always get things right, but imagine a world where we weren't there at all, and it wouldn't be a pretty picture.
Well, I've met Chinese journalists, and I think the British journalists, at least we've still got some, like yourself, Henry, who are prepared to speak out and say what they really think rather than keep their mouths shut in order to keep their job. Anyway, Bernard, what do you make of this potential problem we've got coming in the winter not having enough gas? I mean, this is a shocking thing to hear. I mean, maybe that's to do with privatisation. Gosh, if I'm dare to say that, in the energy industry and all these other strikes which are looming.
Well, I think if we still had our energy under public ownership, as it is in France, we wouldn't have the problems that we're looking at now, staring down the barrel of a pipeline, as it were. If you look at the price of energy that the French are facing, it's a very, very different kettle of fish. As for sort of, before the fiscal budget came out, just about everybody I can think of, apart from nurses, but they've come out just recently. Yes, it's been announced today that, as we mentioned before, that the Royal College of Nursing is going to ballot its members for industrial action. There are so many angry people out there because of the situation we find ourselves in. And this was before the budget, but this is not going to go away. And we're finding, as I've mentioned previously, that on our picket lines we're getting massive support. But then let's look at this fiscal budget, which is a complete act of desperation and failure in my book. You've only got to look back to 1972 and Anthony Barber under the Heath government and how that failed. Then there are other examples going forward of that kind of fiscal policy failed. What I can't understand as well as all of this is okay, so you have this policy, or you want to bring in this policy and the tax issue, etc. Surely to goodness you would cost it first. They didn't do that. Surely to goodness you might consult with people like the IMF and the Office of Budget, whatever they're called.
Responsibility,
thank you. And run it by that. Now, you might not agree with the responses you'd get, but they did none of that. I mean, ineptitude, it doesn't even start.
Worrying, very worrying. Anyway, look, I just wonder what you make, because often the journalists' union is not. It can be quite right wing, can't it? And I know, you know, during the old whopping days, the NUJ was seen as, you know, a bit like the electricians' union, as quite a right wing union. I think it seems clear that it's becoming much more representative. Since, I suppose, journalists don't get the same sort of super special treatment, they're being paid far less than they were, you know, in relative terms. In the 1970s. What do you make of journalism today generally? What's your impression of it, Bernard?
I think there are some very good journalists out there, but obviously the press that's, you know, the ordinary everyday press, I'm not particularly impressed with. Even a newspaper which I read regularly, The Guardian, I sometimes end up sort of being very angry towards it. But certainly there are people like Henry out there who are very good. I get the feeling that they may be in the minority. I hope I'm wrong, Henry, but you know, when you look at the rubbish that comes out in the Mail, Express, let's not even mention the gutter press, but we know who they are. I'm not impressed. But well, no, I must stress to Henry that, you know, I know that there are good journalists out there who are prepared to speak out.
Okay, Bernard. Well, Henry, yeah, do you want to just give us your take on the sort of state of the profession?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's always been a world where there's been incredibly diverse opinions. And everyone should be allowed to have those opinions. And, you know, so, you know, you can look back to Brexit. So that was incredibly divisive. And at the time, I was very much pro-Remainer, but I've sort of switched to being a Brexiteer now. So I appreciate that, you know, opinions can change. And I think it's just the same, you know, across journalists. So you're able to realise they're just members of the public like everyone else, and they've all got opinions, and, you know, they're getting their opinions from, you know, their everyday life experiences as well as from, you know, consuming other mainstream media. So, I mean, it is easy to be critical of coverage within various titles. But, you know, like going back to what I was saying before, I think, you know, as long as we're there to you know, make attempts to hold authority to account and report what's going on, people can just make their own minds up. And it's just with sort of this creep of censorship sort of started with the big tech giants. That's caused the major problems for me. And also another journalist I wanted to mention was Julian Assange, who's, you know, as we know, has been like in custody for like 3.5 years now. And interestingly enough,
in custody of various different sorts for a decade, actually. I mean, he was under house arrest before.
But the NUJ actually has just written an article on their website. I think it was Tim Dawson's written that Assange's conviction would place journalists the world over in a similar jeopardy. Who in the future would report on a classified US document when it might result in a lifetime of medieval style incarceration? And just to update everyone on Assange, I think there's a group that's organizing a campaign to stop his extradition to the US. And there's going to be apparently 3,700 people joining arms around the Houses of Parliament tomorrow to protest it, for, you know, or to campaign for his situation. And I think there's going to be a High Court ruling later this year to decide if Priti Patel's stance can, you know, to get him evicted will be upheld.
Well, that's right. We've got a new Home Secretary now, Suella Braverman. So maybe there's a chance for her to change that decision. Who knows? I mean, you and I, Henry, are almost like a kind of union within a union. We're part of this group holding the line, journalists against censorship. And, you know, I think that's one of the things. I have to bring up this. I don't like talking about stories to do with myself, but YouTube, that is to say Google, have shut down my 15-year-old channel called Public Inquiry this week. They haven't told me exactly which video it was that they didn't like. And the one, it looks as if it was they took it down, was Am I Giving a Biblical Perspective on COVID, back in April 2020, which was actually before they instituted the policies which they've taken my video down for, which were brought in September 2020, I believe. But anyway, which is obviously, you know, it's completely unfair, but I kind of expected this. So that channel, Public Inquiry, was, as I say, was begun 15 years ago. It had 12.5 million views. I had on there two, I mean, lots of interesting documentaries, which we can go through and put. I'll put a picture up on our show page of the back end of that, which will tell you how, you know, some of the, you know, most important documentaries on there, many of them with hundreds of thousands of views. And I think it's interesting, you know, from my point of view, to be able to put up a current affairs documentary that starts getting, you know, in the hundreds of thousands of views, which very few do. I mean, like, for example, Death on the Rock, which was made by World in Action back in the, I think, the early 1990s or late 80s. And another one was the Birmingham Six documentary. That's all gone. And YouTube just pressed the button and down they go. I had also 26,000 subscribers who, every time I uploaded a video, used to get an email. And even so, over the last about 3 years or so, you can search for one of my videos. This is how sneaky they are. You could search for the title of one of my videos on the YouTube search and it wouldn't crop up.
It's like shadow banning, isn't it?
That's right, shadow banned. And there was literally a week about 3 years ago, and I'm not sure what else was going on politically at the time. It might have been when the Russians went into Syria or something like that. That the view counts of my videos, the new ones, went down by a factor of 10. So whereas they were normally getting 3,000-4,000, they started getting 300-400 views. You know, at the same time, of course, Henry, I mean, I don't want to dwell too much on my channel disappearing. You know, I think it's sad, but it was kind of expected. And I've appealed it, so we'll see how that goes maybe next week. But I don't hold out any hope for that, because their appeal process is nonsensical. That actually there's a tremendous amount of knowledge. It's almost as if they're trying to rewrite history, because much of the material I've been doing there has been charting investigations that we've been doing over the last 10 years, Henry.
Yeah. I mean, there's another former journalist who was on YouTube called James Corbett. I think he had like 500,000 followers, and he was just booted off unceremoniously. And he was likening it to the burning of the libraries of Alexandria in Egyptian times, where, you know, all this information that people just put online and it's not in written format, you know, in a physical book, it can just be deleted and never seen again. So it's, you know, an incredibly dangerous creep towards censorship, and that's why that this Holding the Line group that we're both members of sort of made the decision not to have a platform on these censorship control platforms, A, to, you know, protect the content that we do have, and B, to set an example to other content providers that, you know, you're part of the machine that is allowing for this censorship-controlled world to exist. If you're sort of, you know, relying on these censorship platforms to make a living, so I mean, it's incredibly difficult though, because, you know, on Odyssey, I think we've got about 330 followers now. Whereas I imagine if we'd, you know, promoted ourselves on YouTube, we might have had like, you know, 3,000 or so. So yeah, it is difficult, but I think, you know, journalists are, you know, independent ones especially, going to have to start biting the bullet and moving away from the likes of Twitter and YouTube.
YouTube is a bit like a sort of, almost like a kind of honey trap, isn't it? That you think, oh, this is a great platform. You start ploughing a bit of time and effort into it, as I've done over the years, God knows how many hours of material, and then suddenly they pull the rug from underneath you. Anyone that's got a YouTube channel, there's something called Google Takeout. What I would suggest you do, as I did not so long ago, is you go to Takeout, I think it's takeout.google.com, and you just get all your material, so that if they decide to take you down, you you've got backups of everything and you can just put it up on another platform. That's one very good way of getting around Google. Takeout.google.com. Download all your information that you've got up there. So I've got another channel up, which is the Peter Berenius channel. Let's see how that lasts, because that also may be taken out as well. I mean, maybe we'll just round up with you, Bernard, on this as well, because we're being forced into this sort of almost digital world here. And I think for people involved in the railways, part of this is things like having fingerprint recognition and biometrics for workers as they clock in and clock out every day on the railways. And also, of course, getting rid of staff at stations so that people just come in with their credit card or their chip and PIN, and they never actually see a member of staff for the railway.
I've not heard of the fingerprint signing on and signing off before, but certainly with regard to the ticket office, that is a massive issue. And the problem with that is, of course, what about the poor old people that don't have access to computers, can't get online, etc., because that's what it's driving towards. They want to do away with all of the ticket offices if they possibly could, citing the excuse that no one uses them, which is complete rubbish. Lots of people do use them. Yes, of course, more and more people, although, and certainly those that can, are booking their rail tickets online.
What about complicated questions about getting from A to B? Often the rail staff are able to just answer that in a word, whereas if you were to try some sort of online or look it up on some timetable on the wall, it's going to take you all day. I mean, it's just this human touch is absolutely key and crucial, it would seem to me.
Well, of course it is. Yes, exactly. And a couple of words to answer a question or a query that you find very difficult to do online. And of course, you're cutting out so many people, as I've previously mentioned, that don't, for whatever reason, haven't got or can't get access or operate either a computer or a smartphone. And there are thousands of people like that. And it's that's why that's completely wrong.
Yeah, and I think what's happening is we're being sort of honey-trapped into these, oh yes, just rely on the app. Well, what happens when the app doesn't work? What happens when you're locked out of an app because they've decided you know, whether it's your bank app, whether it's something like eBay, your whole entire life and business is run on eBay, and suddenly the eBay app stops working. This is all very, very easy to stop, either by accident or deliberate. And that's the way they want us to go. But we are not going in that direction, Bernard, are we? And I hope not.
I sincerely hope not, no. But this is what they want to do, and this is... It refers back to our previous discussion about how much the 1993 Railways Act is costing us all as a railway. So they're desperately looking to keep the thing going of ways to save money. Shutting ticket offices is one, and there are many other things that they're considering. All this complete rubbish that they come out with about, oh, you've got to come into the 21st century, and all those agreements that you've got, they're all old-fashioned and this, that and the other. What utter rubbish that is, because we all work to collective agreements. And they are negotiated, and they are as up to date as they need to be. We perhaps could be bring them further up to date, but all this stuff about the rail unions being dinosaurs is just mentioned by people who just do not understand. The problem is, and I'll go right back to it again, the 1993 Railways Act. That's what's costing us.
So what's it like for you as a train driver if you're driving a train across the country with just you at the front and no other staff on the train?
It's fine. I've been used to doing that for many, many years. I always used to enjoy it. I never used to like getting up in the middle of the night to take the first one off the depot and the shift work, but actually sat in the cab, running along under green signals, it was something I've always enjoyed.
But what about if there's a problem? Surely you've got to have another member of staff on there on a passenger train in order to make sure things are safe, haven't you?
Of course, on a passenger train, in most cases, but there are some companies that do run driver-only operation, but I've never worked under that scheme. Yes, all the trains I've ever driven, apart from some when I was in the freight sector for a number of years, on the passenger sector I just come out of, just retired from, yes, we had a crew. So I was the driver, obviously, and there was a train manager, and then there was catering staff. So I was head of the team, as it were.
If anything goes wrong, it's kind of crucial to have those other people around.
Absolutely, of course it is, yeah. And in fact, they're finding with driver-only operation, the poor old driver, if he something happens, and dreadful things can happen, unfortunately, rail accidents, then the passengers are all on their own. And a real big thing is on those DOO trains, any disabled passengers, well, they're just there to fend for themselves when they might need assistance. The driver can't help them. And if you were to take through logically how to help someone in a wheelchair or otherwise disabled, then you would have to put the other staff back on the train. And also, it's not just other staff back on the train. I'm talking about a proper train manager or a guard who's got track safety certification. That means they can walk about on the track and they know what the danger is. So you need at least two people on the train.
Anyway, Bernard, what's the best way to follow what's happening with ASLEF and the train strikes, and you know, keep an eye on it? Because quite often a lot of this stuff isn't actually being reported on the TV particularly.
Well, we've just got to keep up the pressure. I'm hoping that there's going to be... the only way it's going to be solved, as the General Secretaries of ASLEF and the RMT have said, is getting round the table and talking and negotiating. And I believe that a solution will be found through that age-old way of going forward. And I hope that for my colleagues who are still working, that that can happen soon. Like I said earlier, there is a ray of hope that the new... Minister for Transport will not block things like Grant Shapps has, and things can be resolved in that manner. But that's the only way that it's going to get resolved. We don't want to be on strike. We really don't, but we find ourselves with no other alternative. Just like the lawyers, the doctors, the nurses, the post office workers, all the other people, that they've found there is no... they've tried every other avenue, and they've found that they have to withdraw their labour. It's a sad situation, and we hope it gets resolved soon.
Well, it always feels like we're in a kind of dying empire. I don't know if you ever feel like that. They've run out of options, and the only thing they can do is try and take money off of anybody that they can manage to. Who industrially weak. They've taken money off of people who are doing a lot of these, sort of single hours contracts jobs. People are getting paid less and less, even though there's a so-called minimum wage. This is another. I don't want to open up another rabbit hole here, but we're getting to the stage where work is not a route out of poverty, Bernard, anymore.
No, I mean, not necessarily, you're right. I mean, but things like these zero-hour contracts and fire and rehire must be opposed at every turn, every time it comes up. Actually, in my position, just after I had left the freight sector, ASLEF came up against, I think it was one of the first trade unions to come across a fire and rehire incident, and we faced up to them and said, basically, when the coal disappeared and stopped being imported and being burnt at the power stations, and there needed to be 800 odd redundancies were announced, and they wanted to sort of fire everybody but just pick and choose who they rehired. ASLEF said, no, you're not doing that. We have a promotion, transfer and redundancy agreement, which we will go through and sort out. First of all, start off the process by asking for voluntary redundancies. But I'm going into detail, which I don't need to, of course. What needs to happen is those sorts of draconian things need to be fought against as soon as they appear.
Yeah, it's a bit like doing it in a kind of more gentlemanly way, isn't it? So everyone can agree to a process rather than just having it imposed on you from the top. Anyway, it's been fascinating insight. Bernard Kennedy, former... Secretary of the ASLEF branch here in Bristol, wish you a very happy retirement, and I'm sure you're going to carry on campaigning right the way through the winter and possibly even beyond that. So thanks very much for joining us. Now, Henry, we're going to get into COVID now, and we're going to hear, to begin with, a little piece about, which was, I think this is from Sky this week, about the public inquiry into COVID-19. Let's see. I wonder if that's going to be any good or not. Henry, it'd be great to get your comments after we've heard this.
I think we were very, very poorly prepared. That is very, very clear. What disturbs me more than the poor preparedness during the first wave is the fact that a lot of the failures continued over time, and they weren't very clear just in hindsight. They were clear when they were happening, and they went against scientific advice even at the time. And I would like to say those failures are continuing now. So in no way, are those things over. We are in the fourth wave. just this year. We're continuing to see deaths. We have 2 million people living with long COVID, and we're continuing to see people, more and more people bereaved, particularly people dying in the clinically vulnerable, disabled and elderly groups. And I think we really need to understand why that was allowed to happen and is continuing to be allowed to happen. Of course, the inquiry won't address all of those parts, but I think if it addresses what happened, at least in the last few years, we can hopefully learn lessons from that moving forward, because I don't feel like that's happened.
And how concerned are you about future waves?
I mean, very concerned. We're obviously in the middle of one. There's absolutely no reason we shouldn't continue to have big waves. We have new variants already on the horizon that are expected to become dominant within a few weeks. And this pattern is likely to continue unless we take action in terms of air quality to actually suppress infection going forward.
So I wonder if this is going to take longer or shorter than the Hillsborough public inquiry. I mean, I'm slightly irritated, Henry, because that was my title of my channel, Public Inquiry, which has just been shut down. I had my little strap line there was documentary makers are just about the only public interest investigators left in the NATO zone. From the top down, our mainstream media, police, political parties and intelligence services are being infiltrated, taken over and controlled from afar. So what do you make of the possibilities of this COVID public inquiry getting anywhere?
Well, I've got my own personal reservations about that. But if it is going to work, then it's going to have to be properly resourced. There's going to have to be entirely independent people running it, no sort of stakeholders or people with conflicts of interest, financial or otherwise. It should be allowed the broadest scope possible, in my opinion, where were all these top-down orders coming from? Looking at China, looking at the World Health Organization. It obviously needs to be given enough time to run a comprehensive look at every single moving part.
The track record is anything to go by, it will just be another cover-up.
Well, I mean, yeah, there are cover-ups. I mean, just going to another one of the most ginormous public inquiries, this is going across the Atlantic to America, the 9/11 Commission report, that was funded to the tune of billions of dollars, whatever. But one of the people who ran that Commission report went on record saying it was set up to fail. they even had Henry Kissinger was going to be running it until a public outcry. So, yeah.
Well, that's right. I mean, just go into that briefly, because I found it quite interesting. It was because they insisted on Henry Kissinger doing a list of all of his potential conflicts of interest that he said, I'm not going to write that list out in public for you. It's my private information. And then they said, well, tough, you can't be on the commission then.
Yeah. Well, which is good. So, yeah, this has to be done in this case as well. They're going to have to find someone who doesn't have any conflicts of interest.
Say a clean skin. But anyway, Martin, Martin, you've been calling for a while for this, haven't you, this public inquiry? I think you kind of knew it was coming down the tracks. Do you think it'll get anywhere?
Well, I mean, there obviously needs to be an inquiry, but whether it will be adequate to these circumstances that it's facing is an open question. Public inquiries in this country, they've changed the law on it some years ago, did they not? Because they used to be judge-led, and then they've changed the setup of that.
And now it's ministerial appointees.
Yeah, that's right. And that, of course, then obviously raises the question,
is it Matt Hancock who appointed the person who's running? Well, obviously it's not. It's a new health secretary. But, I mean, the idea that the government actually appoints the person rather than the judiciary seems as if you don't have much chance, go.
The public inquiries... I mean, the Pat Finucane Centre in Northern Ireland want an inquiry into collusion between the loyalist paramilitaries and the British state, but they don't want that to be a British public inquiry, because they don't trust the British public inquiry system for the reasons I've just suggested, that in actual fact, they used to be judge-led public inquiries and they're now ministerial appointees. But even when you had judge-led inquiries, like the Savile inquiry into Bloody Sunday, that was a whitewash. So the problem with any inquiry is always going to be the question, is it independent? And even if it is, will it be allowed to proceed and do what it needs to do? The 9/11 inquiry, they didn't want to have any inquiry at all at one stage. It was only because people made a fuss that they had to have one. And then, of course, they then, you know, created a, you know, well, an inquiry that didn't properly inquire.
I don't have great hopes for this. I think it's just going to be another whitewash. But because, I mean, Henry, you know, I'm sure you're aware that we've got this enormous great spike across Europe and in the United States and in some other countries, and in New Zealand, for example, in excess deaths at the moment, which is highly likely to be in some way related to COVID. If it's not related to the jabs, it's almost certainly either related to COVID itself or to the excessive social measures which were taken, like the lockdowns. So what do you make of these apparently non-COVID related excess deaths that might in some way be related to what's been going on?
Well, there's two parts to that, actually. There was excess deaths before the rollout of the vaccines, or the injections, as I prefer to call them, the COVID injections. And that was these were non-COVID-related deaths, predominantly at home. So these were ones caused by the lockdown, where people were too fearful to go to the hospitals and they were just dying at home from, you know, other causes.
But these deaths are still going on. I mean, these excess deaths are going up now.
There's a second part where, since the rollout of these injections, Ivor Cummings has done a fascinating YouTube video on it, where he's looked at a corresponding time of these injection rollouts and non-COVID related excess deaths going across both sides of the Atlantic. But yeah, I had a look at some of the excess deaths. Just, you know, look at the mainstream media, and the BBC Scotland reported on their website that you know, deaths non-COVID related were all excess deaths were up 10%. Apparently, 12% were to do with the circulation. That sort of does make you think that maybe the injections are part of the problem, because, you know, myocarditis has been, you know, happening even to sports stars dropping down during competitive sport matches. So, yeah, you would hope that this inquiry does look into that aspect of things. But I get the feeling it's going to end up being a bit of a whitewash, like you say, where it's going to, there's already a narrative being established, you know, across, you know, magazines and, you know, science magazines and science journals, that lockdown was, you know, necessary, a necessary evil, if you like, and it was for the greater good. And if we hadn't have done it, you know, it would have been so much worse. So I do think, yeah, I mean, in my personal opinion, you're looking at, you know, censored scientists and experts and epidemiologists. They seem to think that lockdowns caused far more harm than good, and that harm will roll on for decades. But I don't think the inquiry will go that deep, because it would, you know, it would fundamentally rip out the heart of what their intentions were.
No, well, I mean, the problem is, they're already starting to look at stuff from 2.5 years ago, whereas actually there's loads of things going on right now, like the whole booster jab system, which is happening right at the moment, which may not necessarily actually even be helping people. There's an excellent article in the Business World website by Jimmy Gatula. He's saying, well, the headline is, COVID vaccines may be harming our young. Vaccines more harmful than COVID is the first little sub-headline. The most significant is a study coming from Oxford, Washington, Toronto, Harvard and Johns Hopkins University, which looked at 18 to 29-year-olds boosted with an mRNA vaccine. And what they found was this. To quote, using CDC and sponsor-reported adverse event data, we find that booster mandates may cause a net expected harm per COVID-19 hospitalisation prevented in previously uninfected young adults. We anticipate 18 to 98 serious adverse events, including 1.7 to 3.0 booster-associated myocarditis cases in males and 1.3 to 3.2 cases of grade 3, reactogenicity, which interferes with daily activities. To put it another way, with those below 30 years old, vaccines are more harmful than COVID by a factor of between 20 and 90%. The study continues, given the high prevalence of post-infection immunity, this risk-benefit profile is even less favourable. So what they're saying is, look, if you actually start drilling into these boosters, then actually the best thing to do is just simply not to have one. And in fact, that's been borne out by very many people not actually bothering to get their boosters anymore.
Yeah, just from a personal point of view, you know, our friends, relatives, colleagues that, you know, I know a large number who have decided not to carry on with the, you know, the boosters. And there's a, you probably heard already, there's a top cardiologist in the UK called Dr. Asim Malhotra.
Who's, Malhotra. Yeah, we had him on last week, actually. I had a clip from him last week. Yeah.
And I think News on Cotton Oracle Films have based a documentary around some of
that's
the
right. And that documentary has got the brilliant title Safe and Effective, is the title of their documentary.
Safe and Effective, Our Second Opinion. Yeah. And I started watching it and I had to stop. It was too upsetting, you know, because all of the COVID injection harm victims were speaking, and you know, some you know, had lost relatives, and it is heartbreaking to see.
Well, anyway, this week we have had here in Bristol the University of the West of England COVID vaccination centre has been disrupted and shut down for a second day. So activists in Bristol here, COVID-19 vaccination centre at the University of West of England's French Hay campus was disrupted for a second day yesterday, that was Wednesday, as demonstrators gathered outside the premises. One person who tried to enter the centre for a walk-in appointment said there were about 8 or 10 people hanging around trying to explain their theories. So this is a campaign of leafleting and talking to people, a kind of picket, really. At one point, the centre was reportedly closed to all walk-ins, and people were told unless they had an appointment booked, they wouldn't be let in. One man said, "I left the site at around 12:45, having been informed that no further walk-ins were available today." The anti-vaxxers, as he calls them, and the local paper reports, are still there, and the security guards are very nervous about letting anyone in, understandably. Well, surely there's not really a problem about talking to people and handing leaflets to them as they're going to get their jabs.
Yeah, that seems fine to me. You know, we live in a free country, and just a very interesting point about those walk-in centres. With my Holding the Line hat on, I interviewed a lady this week called Jackie Fletcher, who set up a campaign group called Justice Awareness and Basic Support, acronym JABS, which is looking to support families who've had loved ones harmed by vaccines. And she set this up in 1994 after her own son, who was a toddler at the time, received the measles vaccine with the other ones. And it took her 19 years to get an acknowledgement and compensation from the government that the vaccine had caused those injuries. And she was saying these COVID vaccine drive-in centres, there's no way on earth that the people administering the vaccines can, or the injections, can give those receiving the treatment informed consent, which is a foundation stone of, you know, the medical practice, that you allow the person receiving any form of treatment to weigh up the pros and cons. And so she thinks that this issue of informed consent is, you know, she was let down by it back in 1994, and that it's an ongoing issue that is, you know, reared its ugly head.
Well, look Henry, what paper do you work on, and has there been any pressure on you to report, say, for example? I mean, I understand the Nudge Unit was doing everything it could to get rid of any articles and stop any articles which make people what they call vaccine hesitant. So anything which has got even scientific information, any kind of information really, that someone might look at and think, well, maybe I should wait until the experimental trial of this jab has finished before having it.
Well, I work across a whole group of newspapers in the northwest of England, and I've not come across anything like that where I work. We have had, you know, reports. I've written one myself where we're questioning lockdown, and there's been numerous reports about the injection harm, including a very sad first-hand account of one of the staff members relaying how their own loved one had been harmed. So, Yeah, I think that the word is getting out, certainly where I work, but I have heard, I think I may have mentioned this last time, Mark Sharman from News & Cuts, who's a former Sky news boss, and he was saying that he'd heard directives were made to Sky News reporters not to report on vaccine harm. So if that's true, that's absolutely outrageous, because what is the role of a journalist that is to inform the public?
No, you're wrong. The journalist, particularly in London, from the national press, is there to advertise vaccines for Pfizer, and that is their role nowadays. Look, anyway,
well, can I just I've got to go shortly, but I was just going to mention something on that topic. The BBC's tech editor recently tweeted about how they informed Meta, which is the parent company of Facebook, that people were trying to get around tech censorship in relation to the injections by using a carrot emoji, because there's all this these AI algorithms that seek out the word vaccine, and if it's used in quote marks anti-vax context, things get deleted. So all of these Facebook groups, a bit like jabs, that are looking to support people who've had injection or vaccine harm, that they've just been deleted by Facebook. And this BBC tech editor was saying that, as a result of us informing Meta about carrot emojis being used, these vaccine harm support groups have been deleted. And, I just think, is that really the role of the BBC to shut down debates on vaccine harm? It's quite sad, really.
Well, no, it isn't. And in I think this is WorldNet Daily reported this, researchers are examining data from one of the world's most vaccinated nations, based on weekly government data in New Zealand, one of the world's most vaccinated nations, found that the age groups most likely to have had COVID booster shots had up to 10% more excess deaths. Excess mortality is the number of deaths from all causes above what would be typically expected in 1 year. Authored by John Gibson, economics professor at the University of Waikato, Hamilton, New Zealand, the study found that there were 16 excess deaths per 100,000 booster doses in the country, amounting to more than 400 excess deaths. Now, this is, we're getting to the point now where this inquiry that they're starting to do is way, way, way behind the curve. And before you go, Henry, I know you've got to go in a minute, but I wonder if you could just listen to Dr. John Campbell, because he put out a very, he's quite a well-known YouTuber. He's much cleverer at skipping around their so-called community guidelines, which is basically shooting in the head any producer of content that tells the truth. And he's talking here about Joe Biden and Dr. Fauci. Joe Biden, the U.S. president, and Fauci is the chief advisor to the president, doctor advisor to the president, about their vaccination status as well as his, and whether or not he has yet had his booster jab. So he's very clever here, I think, at pointing out some problems with the jabs, and also whether or not he's prepared to have them anymore, but not getting knocked off YouTube for saying so.
Mr. Biden is 79, therefore pretty high risk if he gets, potentially high risk, being in the older age group. Now, he tested positive on the 21st of July for COVID-19. And he's also had four vaccines. So he's fully vaccinated and two booster doses. So fully vaccinated, two booster doses, and tested positive on the 21st of July 2022. Now, this is a direct quote. Fauci tests positive for COVID-19. Dr. Anthony Fauci, of course. That's a direct quote from CNN I'm quoting in this instance. He tested positive on the 15th of June. Dr. Fauci is 81, so pretty high risk category, it would have to be said, potentially in the high risk category. He's director of something called the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, chief medical advisor to the president, of course. And he's fully vaccinated and had two booster doses and also had a course of Paxlovid. So here we see three people who've had four doses of vaccine each, don't want that, who've had four doses of vaccine each and yet still have tested positive. Now, of course, this is a, to put it mildly, a non-representative sample. of course. And we have to be careful because the YouTube community guidelines here, which we have to abide by, efficacy of vaccines, content claiming that vaccines do not reduce transmission or contraction of disease is not allowed. So clearly I'm not claiming that vaccines do not reduce transmission, and I'm not claiming that they don't prevent the contraction of disease. I'm just pointing out three individuals who are a completely non-random sample and therefore not representative of the public as a whole, but quite interesting. And you now know my vaccine status as well. And I've been sent a reminder to come and get a booster, partly because I'm old, partly because I've already revealed. I don't know. You probably have too much information about me, but I've already told you I'm on blood pressure meds until I can try and improve my lifestyle a bit. Working on it. But I haven't had another vaccine since that one in the 20th of November 2021. Not telling you what to do, of course. Absolutely, emphatically not. I don't know you. You have to make your own decisions, but that's when I had my last one. So there we go. That is full disclosure about me and those other individuals that are in the public domain, which I found really quite interesting. So if you do know what this Davos thing is, do tell me, because I do find it genuinely genuinely curious. I might get around to looking it up myself, but let me know your thoughts. It surprises me, really. I get a lot of comments per video, and I don't have time to read them all, but I do spend about 10-20 minutes a day on them. And the caliber of, obviously, get some drivelling head cases and vindictive people, obviously. First of all, I don't remove comments unless I think they're particularly dangerous. So that's the only time I'll remove them. Or sometimes if they're offensive to other, I don't mind people being offensive to me, but if they're offensive to other people, I'll sometimes remove them as well. But apart from that, the calibre of a lot of the comments again is very, very high. So well worth reading through the comment section of these videos. You get some very highly informed comment, really, really quite insightful very often. So well worth having a look. Anyway, that's us for now. I've had three vaccines, been invited for another one, but my last one was on the 20th of November 2021. And I'll keep you updated, and thank you for watching.
So that's Dr. John Campbell, a bit of a YouTube hit, but he's obviously been very clever at staying on YouTube. Henry, what he seems to be saying there is actually, I'm not having any more of this.
Yeah, that's the way I saw it. You read between the lines. I'll be very surprised to hear he hasn't had his booster. But, you know, informed consent, it's his choice. You know, I'm not going to block him either way. I mean, I wouldn't be suggesting that my opinion should influence him, but yeah, I thought it was very clever there to direct people to the YouTube comments, because I did see it when it was first uploaded. And as he says, the YouTube comments are fantastic. And like 90% of them or more now are saying, not a chance am I having any more of this. So, yeah, I think the worm is turning slow, well, fairly rapidly now. I am going to have to go now. But just to give a very quick plug for Holding the Line, we have the website holding-the-line.com, which has your fantastic reports that, you know, we're sort of lifting the stone up and finding out what's going on. And we've sort of rebranded ourselves as Journalists Against Censorship rather than just Journalists Against COVID Censorship. So we're looking at broader topics now. And we just had a great interview with James Corbett, who I name-checked before, who's released a three-part documentary called False Flags, The Secret History of Al-Qaeda, which is 5 hours worth of documentaries, which is, you know, I thought I knew a lot about 9/11 and the creation of Al-Qaeda, but seeing all these facts and you know, videos and stuff on the mainstream media all stacked up together showing that the, you know, how false flag attacks have been used to manipulate the world right through this century. It's, you know, it's, I would say it's like jaw-dropping and gut-wrenching in equal measure. So, yeah, there's the plug there. And so find us on Odyssey to find that video. All you have to do is just on any internet search engine, just type in Odyssey, O-D-Y-S-E-E, which is the platform for videos that doesn't have any censorship that we use. And then type in Holding the Line, and then you'll find us on there.
Well, that's if you can get the videos to play, because sometimes I have problems doing that, Henry.
Yeah, I've noticed that, but just recently, the past few months, it's been a lot more reliable, so I think they've made it more stable than it used to be. One final thing, I've not had a chance to say hello to Martin, but I'm a big fan of yours, and I love your banter, shall we say, with Tony, and you know, it makes for great listening.
Well, maybe you two can have a brief word about lockdowns, because I know you're not a great fan of them.
I would love to, but I am going to have to go.
Oh, look, you can't butt out. Oh, dear, oh, dear.
I'd definitely love to come back, because you know, I'm a big fan of your show.
Okay, that's brilliant. For, you know, well, there are a few fans out there. One of them has even written a poem about us, which is Patricia O. And I'll just read it out for you now. It's an ode.
I'll stay for that.
An ode to Tony and Martin. Tony and Martin, what a great pair, talking for England with more words to spare, so full of knowledge right off the peg, showcasing liars and other such dregs. Their knowledge immense, compassion shines through, people for people, it's clear to all who listen in each week or catch up in time to be educated in full on the ongoing crimes. They often have words, a clash of beliefs, but patch it up quickly without any grief. A pair of good souls, truly genteel. So thanks, Not the BCFM, for keeping it real. God bless everyone. From Patricia. And so with that, I think we'll say goodbye, Henry. It would be lovely to have you on another time. Yeah. That's Henry Widdus from the North West Lancashire branch of the National Union of Journalists. Thanks very much for joining us.
Yeah, cheers. Bye for now.
The Lord be with you. And with thy Let us pray. Almighty Almighty God, by whose grace we celebrate again the feast of thy faithful servant Swithin, grant that, as he governed with gentleness the people committed to his care, so we, entering with gladness into a rich inheritance, may always seek to build up thy church in unity and love. Through Jesus Christ our Lord, who liveth and reigneth with thee and the Holy Spirit, one God, world without end. Amen. O God, from whom all holy desires, all good counsels, and all just works do proceed, give unto thy servants that peace which the world cannot give, that both our hearts may be set to obey thy commandments, and also that by thee we, being defended from the fear of our enemies, may pass our time in rest and quietness, through the merits of Jesus Christ our Saviour. Lighten our darkness, we beseech thee, O Lord, and by thy great mercy defend us from all perils and dangers of this night. For the love of thy only Son, our Saviour, Jesus Christ.
This cathedral church, the Diocese of Winchester, the Benedictine community of Fleury, and the whole Church of God in Christ Jesus.
Amen. Thank you.
years. Before that, well, not everybody wants to rule the world. Apparently a few people do. We don't. They are. Yes, of course they do. Albert Pike, have a look at him. He's one of the people behind a lot of this, and actually the plan to take over the world and bounce the whole world into this kind of new world order, whether you want to call it world government, whatever. But anyway, that's their plan, and they've been doing it for, I think, for hundreds of years. Martin's not quite up for that. Before that, we had responses and collects. I'm not even quite sure where that's from, but it's rather nice anyway, and I think good to have something sacred. We've got to keep a few things sacred in this world. Apparently we're told that there's nothing sacred anymore apart from money. Anyway, welcome back to Not the BCFM Politics Show. For those that want to bypass the psycho in the corner on the talkradio.org.uk stream and live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app, available free from all good app stores, not necessarily Google, and also on the Apple Store now, with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Starting off again with Ukraine, Martin, and the big announcements this week of the results of the referendum, formal in the east of Ukraine. These parts of Russia, it's might have to remind me, but I think it's Zaporizhia, Lugansk, and Donetsk, and one other part of the country.
Kherson.
All now part of Russia. Now, this is a bit awkward, isn't it? Because quite a lot of those territories are actually held by the Ukrainian army right now.
Yeah, but
So the Russians are going to fight until they get their country back. They've done a bit of a naughty thing there, haven't they? They've claimed land which they don't actually control. So this is rather like the US style of imperialism.
No, I mean, Donetsk and Luhansk already voted in 2014 as oblasts. The whole oblasts voted. The problem they've got in the other two is that they control most of the areas of those two oblasts, but they don't control all of them. Now, if they waited until they did control all of them before they had a vote, that would undermine the political purpose of having the vote, which is at this moment now to consolidate what the Russian military have won on the ground and to create the political conditions going forward into the next phase of this conflict. So they had to do that. You know, the Kosovo Liberation Army didn't control Kosovo when we went to war with Serbia. They were shooting Serbian soldiers and police officers and also terrorising people in their own community.
That's what wars are about.
That's what wars are about.
Yeah, so is it? Do you think wise of the Russians to say we are considering these referendums in territories that they haven't actually, you know, large parts of which haven't actually had a referendum?
It's not large parts. There's some parts.
No. Large parts of them.
Donetsk.
Let's look at the other end. The place, I think it's Kherson province or Zaporizhia province is, you know, roughly half of it is nobody voted at all because they're on the Ukrainian side.
Well, we'd have to look at that. And, of course, looking at the...
It's clearly not a proper referendum if only the parts the Russians control have had a referendum, is it?
No, but you can't have a proper referendum until you've won the war, or you've got to have it before you've won the war. This is what happens. The South seceded from the North of the United States, and they didn't wait to be told whether they could or couldn't do that, because that's what happens in wars, like that war. They lost in the end and all the rest of it. But, you know, that's, you know, these kinds of referendums are often held in disputed circumstances. In Nagorno-Karabakh, people voted to leave Azerbaijan and to join with Armenia. But the Azerbaijanis didn't accept it, and there was a war in the 2000s, and it's been going on ever since.
The latest here, this is yesterday, is Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky called for NATO to launch a preemptive strike on Russia to prevent Moscow from using nuclear weapons. Now, I'm not sure a preemptive strike on Russia would prevent Moscow from using nuclear weapons. It might deter them, potentially, maybe not. It might actually make them use nuclear weapons, a move that would almost certainly spark World War III and possibly nuclear war, according to Dave DeCamp on antiwar.com. What should NATO do? Exclude the possibility of nuclear weapons by Russia, Zelensky said on video link to an Australian think tank, the Lowy Institute, on their podcast. But the most important, I'm again addressing the international community, is how it was before February the 24th. Preventive strikes so that they know what will happen if they use a nuke, he said.
Well, I think this is Zelensky losing the plot. There is no hope whatsoever. Any attack on the Russian Federation to prevent them using nuclear weapons, presumably it would have to be either a conventional attack or a nuclear attack. If it was a nuclear attack, the Russians have made their position clear. We will fire back and we will incinerate you. So if Zelensky's calling for that, he's calling for nuclear war.
Well, today,
I presume he's calling for a conventional attack, but a conventional attack on Russia means that Russia is then directly attacked by NATO, and NATO and Russia go to war straight away.
Well, that's bang, right. Crash, no, that's true.
And no doubt Zelensky wants that, but whether we in Bristol want to go to war with Russia to keep Zelensky happy is another matter.
I mean, it's quite clear,
as
Zelensky loses, and he is losing, despite what you hear on the press, as he slowly loses, he's going to more and more extreme measures to try and drag NATO into this.
Yes, well, he said he wanted to join NATO immediately, and then he was immediately told, no, you can't. Not least because countries like Hungary, which are part of NATO, would veto them joining.
Well, it's not just that, is it? There's a major territorial dispute and a war going on in Ukraine.
Yes.
So Ukraine cannot join NATO by its own constitution.
Yes, that's true. But at the same time, of course, from the Russian point of view, Shoigu pointed out after Putin spoke the other day as the defence minister, we're already at war with NATO. We know we are.
Well,
effectively, that's what's got. British military personnel are embedded in the Ukrainian armed forces as we speak.
So this is again, Dave De Camp yesterday on antiwar.com. US Special Operations Forces are on the ground in Ukraine. US Special Operations Forces are on the ground in Ukraine as part of a broad covert operation that includes CIA personnel, The Intercept reported on Wednesday, citing unnamed US intelligence and military officials. The report said that the US withdrew its CIA and Special Operations assets from Ukraine shortly before Russia's intervention, although one US official said the CIA never completely left. The CIA initially predicted that Kiev would fall quickly on to Russia, but after it became clear that wouldn't happen, the Biden administration sent its covert assets back into Ukraine. The report said that US clandestine operations inside Ukraine are now far more extensive than they were earlier in the war, when US intelligence officials were fearful that Russia would steamroll over the Ukrainian army. In other words, they got out of the way. Several current and former intelligence officials said there is a much larger presence of both CIA and US special operations personnel and resources in Ukraine than there were at the time of the Russian invasion in February. This CIA presence in Ukraine, I mean, it's not clear what the US personnel are actually doing in Ukraine or where exactly they're operating, according to this report on The Intercept. But the presence risks provoking Russia. The covert operations contradict Biden's pledge not to send troops into Ukraine, which he said before Russia's invasion could spark a world war. And he's actually, funnily enough, talking about a similar thing now. Today, Biden is coming out and saying a nuclear Armageddon risk is the highest since 1962 and comparing what's going on now to the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Yes, well, I mean, lots of people have been saying that from the very beginning, including the Russians, who've been pointing out that if you were going to rip up the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty, which is what you did a couple of years ago, and you're going to bring short-range nuclear missiles into Europe pointing in our face, then we are going to take action to prevent that, just as you did in Cuba in 1962. So, and of course, what Biden is also forgetting is that all the other occasions we nearly blew ourselves to smithereens, like in 1983, when a flock of swans nearly led to a nuclear holocaust. And the idea that we've, there's never been any problems since 62 is wrong.
But this is way beyond that, Martin. That's way beyond that.
Oh, of course it is. No, it's not way beyond that, because we nearly did it. I mean, what's happening now is there's no communication going on.
Well, I'm saying, okay, so in peacetime, a flock of swans can cause it. But in wartime, actually, all sorts of maybe, for example, fake intelligence, like weapons of mass destruction that don't exist, things like that, as that intelligence comes in, an incoming strike, that sort of thing, we're on a hair trigger than we were in peacetime, even during the Cold War.
No, there wasn't. 1983 wasn't peacetime. It wasn't peacetime in Angola. It wasn't peacetime in Mozambique.
It was peacetime in Europe.
Well, that's a very self-referential
No, it's peacetime. What we're saying here is that actually Europe is far more likely to be a major conflagration than one of these conflicts that takes place away from, you know, either the Russian Soviet Western border or elsewhere. I mean, this is the potential heartland for a third world war, isn't it?
It is, and of course the one strategic response the Russians could take is to put short range nuclear weapons into Cuba, Venezuela, or Nicaragua. And of course, if they did that, the Americans would go absolutely nuts. And the Russians say, well, if we did that, you'd go nuts. Now you're doing exactly the same thing to us. Now what do you expect us to do here? Now that's leaving aside all the rights and wrongs of the war in Ukraine. We're talking about just nuclear security. Yeah, there was always going to be the case that the Russians weren't going to accept short-range missiles in their face in Western Europe. That's exactly what the issue was in the 1980s, which nearly led to World War there, because there's a basic asymmetry. Because NATO-US-aligned Europe is much closer to Russia than Russian-aligned states are to the United States, there's always an asymmetry in the nuclear calculation that the two sides
have to
make.
Let's have a listen to President Biden, who at the weekend had his reaction to this holding of hands ceremony. What did you think of that? Holding hands, but it was a little bit... This is the new presidents of these new areas of Russia, which are now part of the Russian Federation in eastern Ukraine, with Putin in Russia, after the results of these so-called referenda. I mean, you know, you can call them sham. And the reason that the Western media are calling them sham referenda is because not because, you know, it's because they're not actually, it's like having a Bristol election where only North Bristol gets to vote, South Bristol is not allowed to vote.
Well, that's because the Ukrainians won't allow the people on the part of the land they control to vote. That was exactly what the Minsk agreements were all about. We've already had a vote in Donetsk and Luhansk in 2014 where overwhelmingly people voted to leave the Ukraine. Now, what we could negotiate with you, we will rerun those referendums with you participating as well, and we'll just confirm what we voted for in 2014.
So the holding hands...
But the reason why the Ukrainian army is plonked on the top of Luhansk and Donetsk is to prevent the fulfilment of the people's will in 2014. Now, they could have said, we'll withdraw from this, and you can have a proper vote. Just like we were talking about Kashmir
the other
day.
Yeah, but they're in the middle of a war, Martin. This isn't going to happen.
Well, in that case, you can't blame the Russians because people can't vote in areas controlled by the Ukraine.
Well, it does mean that it's not really a proper election. I mean, anyway.
Well, what's a proper election, Tony?
It's an election where people get to decide. And in this case, a lot of the people on the west of that front line of the fighting haven't had a chance
to partake in it, have they?
No. And I mean, so it does make it a little bit farcical. Anyway, let's have a listen to President Biden's reaction to the holding hands ceremony with Russian President Vladimir Putin and the presidents or new presidents of, or I imagine they're sort of interim
they're prime ministers,
of
I think,
of Kherson,
they're prime
Zaporizhia,
not presidents.
Donetsk, and Lugansk. And this is what Biden had to say in response.
America and its allies are not going, let me emphasize, are not going to be intimidated. Are not going to be intimidated by Putin and his reckless words and threats. He's not going to scare us, and he doesn't or intimidate us. Putin's actions are a sign he's struggling. The sham referenda he carried out and this routine he put on. Don't worry, it's not on there if you're looking, okay? The sham routine that he put on this morning that's showing the unity and, you know, as people holding hands together. Well, the United States is never going to recognize this. And quite frankly, the world's not going to recognize it either. He can't seize his neighbor's territory and get away with it. It's simple as that. And they're going to stay the course. They're going to continue to provide military equipment so that Ukraine can defend itself and its territory and its freedom, including additional resources that the Congress is going to give me today of $13 billion more dollars to help the Ukrainians defend themselves and fight back. And we're fully prepared to defend. I want to say this again. America is fully prepared with our NATO allies to defend every single inch of NATO territory. Every single inch. So, Mr. Putin, don't misunderstand what I'm saying. Every inch. And I've been in close touch with our allies. We're announcing new sanctions today as well. that including new authorities to sanction anyone who provides political or economic support to Russia's fraudulent territorial claims. And I've been in close touch with our NATO allies, who are united in our resolve to take on his aggression. So I thank you all very much. You also asked me earlier about the pipeline, and let me say this. It was a deliberate act of sabotage, and now the Russians are pumping out disinformation and lies. We're going to work with our allies to get to the bottom exactly precisely what happened. And as at my direction, I've already begun to help our allies enhance the protection of this critical infrastructure. And at the appropriate moment, when things calm down, we're going to be sending divers down to find out exactly what happened. We don't know that yet exactly, but we're not, just don't listen to what Putin is saying. What he's saying, we know is not true.
Well, it's a pretty sloppy presser by Biden, wasn't it? The pipeline stuff is just, I mean, he's gone about, the rest of the world understands. The rest of the world has already made up its mind. It was definitely NATO, deep state.
Yeah, well, it's amazing that he's saying it's sabotage. You think, really? Surely, never. You know, and this, the idea that it could be anybody except the NATO side.
It may well be that Putin doesn't know directly who did it. Just like George W. Bush didn't know who carried out the 9/11 attack.
I don't know if you've seen, there was a US helicopter flying around, helicopter, a few days before it happened.
That's right, they actually carried out a NATO exercise using unmanned submersibles in exactly the place where this happened. Okay? So if you were Inspector Clouseau, you start to put a few things together, even Clouseau could work out what happened here. And, of course, what happens when the deep state does stuff like this? They don't necessarily brief Biden. Yeah, he doesn't give the order to blow up the pipeline. They blow it up, and then they tell him the Russians did it. And he says, oh, yes, well, my people are telling me it's the Russians who did it. Because, of course, he doesn't know. He hasn't got a clue. But people around the world, you know, the government of India, the government of China, the governments of various African countries like South Africa and so on, they're all going, yeah, the Russians blew it up. We believe you. Except they don't. Nobody believes it.
Let's have a listen now to Scott Ritter. I think he was speaking here to Ray McGovern this week, talking about the reality on the ground of what the results of these referenda in these various territories on the east side of Ukraine, what it actually means in reality.
From a Russian perspective, this is a victory. It cannot be seen as anything else other than a victory. And for the people of the region who voted, this has to be a glorious day. It has to be a glorious day for all Russians. But, you know, after the documents are signed, we still have reality. We have the reality that there's an ongoing conflict. We have the reality that a significant part of Kherson Oblast is still occupied by Ukrainian forces. Zaporizhia still has Ukrainian forces. A significant part of Donetsk still has Ukrainian forces. Winter is coming. You know, it's one thing to say that these regions are now part of Russia. It's another thing to make them part of Russia, meaning to bring the services in, to bring in medical services, to bring in gas, energy, proper governance. This is a significant financial burden that Russia has assumed on itself, not only in terms of completing the military conflict, but bringing these four districts up to Russian standard. What is the Duma going to do about that? Is there money set aside to make this happen? What's the future look like for the people who said we want to be part of Russia? Now, how do they become part of Russia?
Well, that obviously is a big question. I mean, what you were saying earlier about how these referenda are, you know, they're still occupied places in Kherson and so on. When the Americans declared independence of Britain in 1776, the war was still raging. It didn't end for another 10 years. But eventually, of course, the Americans kicked the British out and the Declaration of Independence was made before they'd won the war. Okay? So when people say that they can't do this until they've won the war, that's wrong. It's part of winning the war to make such declarations. Slovenia, busted its way out of Yugoslavia in 1991 by opening fire on the Yugoslav National Army without warning, and in 60 days, the 60-day war, they drove the Yugoslav National Army out and they declared independence. They didn't wait for permission from Belgrade. That's not how these things work, is it?
No, it certainly isn't.
In 1918, when Sinn Féin won all the seats in the Dáil, they fanned the Dáil. They didn't take their seats up in Westminster. They met in Dublin and they declared independence for their country. This is how these things are done. The question is, how much popular support do they actually have? And I think anybody objectively will realise that they were very unhappy in the Ukraine from the get-go when 1991 happened and the Soviet Union collapsed. Many Russian speakers in the east of Ukraine weren't happy with what happened. And after all the killing and destruction and the sacrifice, they are never going to be ruled by Kiev again.
You're comparing this to Northern Ireland in a way has a resonance of truth about it. I mean, you've got the Northern Irish culture being actually quite different to that in Southern Ireland at the time of partition, you know. So what's happened is there's two rather different types of people, different cultures, different faiths, different ideas, and being told, no, you're going to have to live together. Well, in a way, it's kind of bound to. If it's done on territorial, like I remember years ago being in Singapore and seeing how the Singapore government had decided that although they had lots of different ethnic minorities in Singapore, the Chinese, the Indians, and they had their own special quarters for these people, that they wanted to make sure that all of the public housing in Singapore was completely equally spread between all the different ethnic minorities so that they didn't get into these silos.
Yeah, and of course Singapore busted out of Malaysia because they didn't want to be part of Malaysia, which was a state that had been created by the British. Now, in actual fact, there's a limit to how far you can compare one situation with another. There are different situations all over the world.
But what I'm saying is that you had a very geographically separate bunch of people in Ukraine all the time.
Yes, and this was always going to be a potential problem. But what actually happened in Ukraine as an independent state is that there was a bit of a back and forth between the two communities. So sometimes there was a more pro-Western government, but they had to talk to the more pro-Russian eastern country, part of the country, and vice versa. And
none of this would have been a problem if it hadn't been for Victoria Nuland's billions and the Nazis. Yeah.
Well, I mean, the point is, the Ukrainian politics had many faults. It was oligarch-run, the privatisation process was a shambles, it gave the wrong people the money, just as that happened in Russia itself. But all politicians up to the coup in 2014 realise that they've got to do deals to hold the country together, which means that even if you run the election, you're going to have to listen to the views of the other side and try. And if there is a united Ireland in the long term, that will be because both sides have actually compromised in order to come to get there. Now you can't compare everything. There are similarities in all of these conflicts, but there are also differences, and it depends, doesn't it? What is the actual views of the people on the ground on both sides?
I want one thing that Pete Marshall sent, he's a photographer, retired photographer in London, sent me during the week. I thought, terrific article, Ukrainian billionaires exchange luxury apartments, I think it was, luxury real estate in a secret settlement, which I didn't know anything about. He calls it, the article calls it the Battle of Trafalgar. I'll put this up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk because it's so fascinating. I think that London is a centre for these things. On the 2nd of February 2016, 10 days after the secret settlement had been concluded amongst this is basically a little bit of a financial and economic war that was going on between the Ukrainian oligarchs. Pinchuk, Kolomoisky and Bogliubov, Appleby, heard from Hogan Lovells again. It looks like we will shortly have an additional piece of corporate work on this matter, which we would really appreciate your assistance with. As part of the settlement, which your current engagement relates to, this is kind of legal speak, isn't it? But he says the other parties agreed to transfer two high-value prime London commercial properties to Mr. Pinchuk. This is, of course, the guy who 2 years before had been behind the actual coup, if you've been following that. Viktor Pinchuk, as the Masonic boss of Kiev, was actually ordering the Bearcut riot police around that day and making sure that the coup happened all according to plan. Well, the fact of the matter is the Grand Hotel on Trafalgar Square was what they're talking about here, changed hands, and it's now owned by Viktor Pinchuk, which is also the location, someone was telling me, of one of the very hush-hush civil service clubs as well. So, you know, this is where they are, right in the middle of Trafalgar Square, and the Grand Hotel, which has been there for centuries, one of the main things of Trafalgar Square, is all controlled and owned by the main oligarch, is an Israeli, dual Israeli Ukrainian citizen of Ukraine, Martin.
Well, in actual fact, London has got the oligarchy of the world all have pads in London. The Nigerians, the Romanians, the Taiwanese, they're all there.
Anyway, I just find it fascinating when there's all this talk about what's going on over in the east of Ukraine, whatever. But actually, look at Trafalgar Square. Next time you're going out of Charing Cross Station, you turn left towards Northumberland Avenue. This is the main oligarch of Ukraine's pad in London, where he does all his stuff, about £250 a night, I think. I looked up the prices if you wanted to stay there.
Free if you own it.
Of course. And all sorts of dodgy deals can be done there. Of course, just over from Admiralty Arch, very central, just down from Pall Mall and all the big London clubs, you know, sort of Reform Club and all that. Just a little stroll down and there you are, Viktor Pinchuk's pad. Little deals can be done in those clubs very, very quietly. So I'll put a link up to that on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. The Battle of Trafalgar, I rather like to call it, that article. But anyway, look, at the end of the day, back over in Ukraine, Martin, the end of the story has got to be, there's a lot of talk from the West, particularly from Biden, we just heard there about, well, we'll stand up, we will not give an inch of NATO, but we will stand up in, maybe Ukraine might be taken by the Russians, but we are going to stand up to them. The question Ray McGovern put to Scott Ritter, or the moderator of the discussion put to Scott Ritter, was, can NATO really stand up to Russia?
Russia is hoping that the expense of trying to stand up to Russia would be too much for Europe. Now, is Russia right on this? I don't know. I don't know. It's hard to predict the future. If the West senses weakness on the part of Russia, if the West senses that, you know, while Russia could seize the eastern part of Ukraine but not finish the job, that might bring some resolution to this. Turkey, you know, everybody's, you know, applauding Turkey, but Turkey didn't oppose Finland joining because that is a suicide pill for NATO. It is. That's not why Turkey said no. Turkey said no because the Scandinavians provide safe haven and succor to the PKK, to the Kurdish groups. And they say, you guys support terrorists. We're not going to allow a repeat of the Greece situation where Turkey said Greece can rejoin NATO. And then Greece turned around to stab Turkey in the back, according to the Turks. So the Turks aren't willing to allow that to happen. But it has nothing to do with the security threat posed by Finland joining NATO. The same thing with Slovakia's objections. It's not that, oh my God, we would never let Finland join because this would be the end of us all. It's, no, we're pissed off at them. Excuse my language. We're irritated with them about, you know, their policies toward Croatia and things of that nature. These are things that the United States and others can seek to paper over with incentives, bribery, cajoling, threats, etc. You know, the point I bring up is that Finland's still a big problem and Russia's not backing down and they will not allow Finland to join NATO. That's my firm belief. They will not allow this to happen. And that means that Russia will destroy Finland as a modern nation state before they allow Finland to join NATO. Sweden, I don't, you know, I think Sweden would pay a price. But Finland is on the chopping block. Their head is there, and there's nothing that can save Finland. And that's the point I wanted, you know, I tried to make with Ukraine. There's nothing that can save Ukraine. Ukraine is gone because Russia eventually is going to transition away from a special military operation to a war, and they are going to eliminate the Western Ukrainian safe haven. They're going to destroy Kiev as a political center of gravity, and they're going to do the same thing to Finland. And NATO can do nothing to stop them because NATO has nothing to stop them except nuclear weapons, and Russia has its own nuclear capability. But this is a very dangerous situation because the more Russia acts out in this matter, the more difficult it is for NATO, because you know you have a lot of people saying, "Oh, we can't push Putin into a corner. Remember, we got to give Putin an off ramp." You know that the opposite's true too. You can't push NATO into a corner. You can't push the United States into a corner. There's got to be an off ramp, and I can't imagine a scenario that has NATO saying, "Yeah, well, we'll allow this new European security framework after Russia destroys both Ukraine and Finland." I can't imagine a scenario where NATO's going to go, "Yeah, now we want to back down. Now we want to be." No, I think it's going to double the resolve, and it's going to end up with a war in Poland, because Poland's just an insane nation that in the Baltics. These are crazy nations that's never been allowed into NATO. They view NATO as the shield and the sword that they can employ against the threat. They have centuries worth of grievances building up. And I see nothing but trouble, danger looming. I don't see a negotiated settlement here. I don't. And I don't know if Russia's strong enough to win against everybody. You know, Russia's strong. Russia has capability. But the idea that Russia, even under general mobilization, would be able to successfully push back against a resolute NATO that itself mobilizes is might be wishful thinking on the part of the Kremlin. So we're heading in a direction where neither side will back down, and neither side is being afforded a diplomatic off ramp, and that just spells trouble for everybody.
Well, I mean, obviously, I respect greatly what Scott Ritter says, but I feel there is some differences with that analysis.
Good,
because
yeah. I mean, Finland. The idea of Finland is, you know, is that going to,
well,
is it going to happen?
Well, what Putin said is that from a point of view, we're disappointed that Finland and Sweden have decided to join NATO, but it doesn't change anything on the military side for now, provided you just carry on doing what you did previously and don't allow other military forces from the other NATO countries into Finland and Sweden, for example, short-range nuclear missiles, for example, then it's something we can live with. We're not happy about it, but we can live with it. And of course, obviously, you know, if you're coming to us for any favours, Finland, you can whistle for it because you've annoyed us here. And Finland, of course, historically, there's a very good chapter in Jared Diamond's book about this, who's a very good social scientist and scientist, pointing out that Finland, because they went to war with the Soviet Union in the 1940s, the Winter War between Finland and the Soviets, they won the war and preserved their independence. They then joined with the Germans to attack and besiege Leningrad, which of course caused enormous annoyance to the Soviets, to the Russians. You know, a million people died in that, and the Finns were responsible because they were blocking one side of the city. But at the end of the war, the Finns very wisely decided, we are not joining any anti-Soviet alliances. And they were put under a lot of pressure by the British, the Americans, etc. You're going to have to join NATO. And they said, no, we're not joining NATO. We've been to war with the Soviet Union. We've suffered. They tried to overtake our country. Finland used to be part of the Russian Empire, historically. But they decided we're going to be an independent country and we're not going to join NATO. And in actual fact, the relationship they had with the Soviet Union was very positive on the back of that. But they've decided, the left-wing government in Finland, in other respects I would probably support, have thrown away all of the diplomacy that they used to be able to...
Isn't it more simple than that? That in the West, almost every single country, the leadership has been stuffed with infiltrated basically with people who are absolutely loyal to the Western banking system and the Western oligarchy. And if they're not loyal, then they won't get into power.
Well, that's true to an extent, and you can certainly see it in Germany, where the Green Party have morphed into being the party of war.
Well, we've got these people,
they are the most extreme in saying we're going to fight Russia to the last Ukrainian.
Yale World Fellow types and the World Economic Forum global leaders of tomorrow. These are the people that have been propelled into these positions. Almost everything we hear about Putin is negative, bad, bad, bad. He's basically in a situation situation where he's been not necessarily forced, but by through these threats of the, you know, the Ukrainians getting nuclear weapons, it's quite understandable that doesn't want that to happen, and he wants to do everything he can to stop that happening, particularly with the propensity of real genuine Nazis in Ukraine. And he's been painted as this kind of Emmanuel Goldstein figure from Orwell's 1984. Goldstein was, I think he was the principal enemy of Oceania, which is the so-called home country of Winston Smith, and he's the founder of and the leader of an organization called the Brotherhood. He's written something called The Theory and Practice of Oligarchical Collectivism. This is the character, it seems to me, that Putin is being painted as.
Well, I mean, you know, 1984 is fiction, and then we've got the real world. In 2014, Umas Piets, who was the Estonian foreign minister, phoned up Catherine Ashton, who was British, ex-Labour Party politician, who was the head of the EU's foreign policy team, and he told her that the people who'd been shot down in the Maidan Square had been shot by pro-Western snipers. And he confirmed to Agence France-Presse that that was the case, right? So in 2014... The Estonians, now Estonian and Finnish are quite related languages. So some people in Finland could probably understand Estonian and vice versa. I very much doubt that the Prime Minister of Finland, who's in her 30s, even has taken on board the fact that in 2014, Umas Piets confessed that that was what was going on. He didn't do it publicly. And of course, within 2018, there was a court case in Kiev which showed that the Burkitt Riot Police didn't shoot those people. Now, I'll tell you what, I don't think that the left-wing woman who runs the Social Democrat Party and is Prime Minister of Finland, my name escapes me now, she was pilloried the other day for partying too hard and all the rest of it. I don't think these people know these facts. That's the problem.
Well, she's probably in that job.
They get to position being Prime Minister without knowing these things.
She is in that job because she's easy to manipulate, rather like our own Prime Minister.
Well, indeed, I don't suppose Liz Truss knows these things either.
Rather like our own Mayor here in Bristol too. Anyway, let's finally wind up looking at Ukraine by hearing Liz Truss in her big speech. She also talked about Ukraine, of course, at the Conservative Party conference this week.
My friends, we cannot have security at home without security abroad. That's why our tough foreign and defence secretaries are updating the integrated review to make sure we can face down these threats. It's why we're increasing defence spending to 3% of GDP by the end of the decade. This will ensure that our armed forces are ready to tackle new and emerging threats. We're working with our friends and allies to support Ukraine in the face of Putin's brutal war. The brave Ukrainian people... The brave Ukrainian people aren't just fighting for their security, but for all our security. This is a fight for freedom and democracy around the world. Putin's illegal annexation of Ukrainian territory is just the latest act in his campaign to subvert democracy and violate international law. We should not give in to those who want a deal which trades away Ukrainian land. They are proposing to pay in Ukrainian lives for the illusion of peace. We will stand with our Ukrainian friends however long it takes. Ukraine can win, Ukraine must win, and Ukraine will win.
So a great long round of applause there. I think it's the biggest round of applause that Truss got in her speech, Martin. The Tories seem to be 100% behind her.
Yes, and many people in the Labour Party as well, sadly. Tikhanovskaya spoke at the Labour Party conference. She's the leader of the opposition in Belarus. And she spoke at the Labour Party conference. And obviously, the leadership very much in favour of her speaking. And we're also very few Labour MPs have actually made any kind of criticism of the general policy towards Ukraine. This is depressing, but it's just the reality. And of course, the reality is that they can puff and they can puff, but the British army will never defeat the Russian army. It's just not going to happen. We could probably defend Britain against a Russian attack, but any attempt to attack Russia, and of course we had...
We've got all our NATO colleagues, so we would be side by side, shoulder to shoulder with them.
Yes, and that's when the Turks and the Greeks have sorted out the issue of Northern Cyprus, when the Turks have... Basically, the Turks were calling for negotiations, and they actually led negotiations between Kiev and the breakaway republics and the Russians, in Istanbul in April of this year, and then the British said, no negotiations, fight to the finish. Now, we invaded the Crimea in the 1850s, and Ben Wallace, who was our defence secretary, used to be a captain in the Scots Guards, and he's on the record of saying the Scots Guards kicked the Russians' backsides in the 1850s in Crimea, and I'm sure we could do it again. And you feel like saying to him, so why did we invade the Crimea? And why do you think the Russians, whose country it was, fought you when you did invade them? Well, what business does Britain have in the Crimea? And the answer is none at all. We didn't have any in the 1850s, and we've got none today. And if you go to war with other people in their country, like in the East Ukraine that's just declared independence, just like the American Declaration of Independence, they're going to fight back very, very hard.
Yeah, you said that. Anyway, James Cleverly is our Foreign Secretary, Lieutenant Colonel James Cleverly. Again, is it a good idea to have ex-army officers as Foreign Secretary? He's got a background in publishing, and he managed to get a seat on the London Assembly too.
Well, I didn't know that he had a military background. He's probably a reservist, isn't he?
Yes, he was. Yeah, yeah. Territorial Army.
Okay, well, I mean, there's no particular reason why you shouldn't, but there's no particular reason why you should. Shoigu is a general or a field marshal. But, of course, in the Russian system, the people who actually run the government aren't elected. They're appointed by the elected people. So Shoigu doesn't get elected. He gets appointed by Putin, who is elected, which means, of course, that he actually knows what he's on about. Unlike Liz Truss, when she was foreign secretary, she's up against Lavrov, who's a career diplomat. That's all he's ever done. And she can't even remember the difference between the Black Sea and the Baltic.
I said the last clip, but I think we should give the last word to Lavrov. I didn't have any clips from him speaking at the United Nations last week at the UN General Assembly. And so I think it'd be quite nice to hear the last couple of minutes of his speech, where he kind of he actually talks here, Martin, about something that we've... In fact, it's one of the videos which was taken down by YouTube this week on my Public Inquiry channel, which is our interview with the producer from the Swedish state broadcaster about the assassination of Dag Hammarskjöld, the Secretary General of the United Nations,
who was
killed in 1961. But it was the Swedish national broadcaster that made the film about Dag Hammarskjöld, whether or not he was Norwegian. But anyhow, he slams the West here. Lavrov slams the West for the grotesque Russophobia. But he starts by looking at what on earth happened with Dag Hammarskjöld.
We think that the priority here is to overcome the impasse in creating an independent Palestinian state, restoring the state of Iraq and Libya, destroyed by NATO aggression, neutralize the threats to Syria, having a sustainable process of national conciliation in Yemen, overcoming the heavy burden of NATO presence in Afghanistan. And we are working on restoring the original JCPOA on Iran, a nuclear program, ensuring the comprehensive settlement on the Korean Peninsula. Many conflict situations in Africa require that we reject the temptation to play a zero-sum game there, and that outside players consolidate around the initiatives by the African Union. We are concerned by the situation in Kosovo, Bosnia-Herzegovina, where the United States and the EU are stubbornly leading to the destruction of the international legal basis as we currently have it in Resolution 1244 and the Dayton Peaceful Agreement. Madam President, at times like these, it's natural to seek wisdom from our predecessors. So in the pithy expression of the former Secretary General Doug Hammarskjöld, who remembered the horrors of World War. He said, and I quote, "The UN wasn't created to take mankind to paradise, but rather to save humanity from hell." These are very topical words. They call upon us to understand our individual and collective responsibility for creating conditions for a peaceful and harmonious development for our future generations, and everyone needs to show political will for that. When we are ready for such honest work, and we are convinced that the stability of the world order can be ensured exclusively through returning to the origins of the UN diplomacy, basing ourselves on the key principle of true democracy, the respect for the sovereign equality of states. I thank you.
So, yes, that was Sergei Lavrov speaking at the UN last weekend. And I think Martin, you know, he didn't start off talking about Doug Hammarskjöld, but he wound up talking about that. I mean, by also obviously saying that he wanted to see these Middle East conflicts sorted out, as we all do. But Doug Hammarskjöld wasn't Norwegian. No, he was a Swedish economist and diplomat. He served as the second Secretary General of the United Nations from April 1953 until his assassination in a plane crash in September 1961. So brilliantly looked at by Cold Case Hammarskjöld, made by the Swedish national broadcasters. And Andreas Roxson, who was the producer, was on this show, I think it was about 2 years ago. A fascinating interview about how that documentary got made and what really happened. I think one of the most incredible spin-offs, just to go down that rabbit hole for a second, was the Saimar Far Right Private Army that had been cooperating in the assassination of Dag Hammarskjöld down in South Africa also was injecting black people with AIDS just for fun. And they told these indigenous people, I think it was which country? Not sure. Anyway, in east of Africa, just north of South Africa, that this was a vaccine that they were giving them, but actually what they were doing was deliberately injecting them with AIDS.
Yeah, well, I mean, the assassination of Doug Hammarskjöld was carried out by Western intelligence services,
and in conjunction with the UN mining,
Secretary General of the UN,
the big mining companies.
Yes, that's right. From a vested interest, but MI6 definitely know who did it because they were involved, and in fact they've almost admitted it. Patrice Lumumba's, who was the president of Congo, where all this this stuff was going on, his remains have been transported back, I believe, to Congo, and the Belgian government have accepted that they assassinated him.
But I mean, what Lavrov's talking about in that speech is really, he's painting a picture of the Western leaders as a kind of oligarchy that's a psychopathic oligarchy that's having a massive hissy fit.
Well, that's right, and it's not inaccurate. The Western media have got most of the population completely bamboozled. Most people before this recent spat in the Ukraine hadn't really heard of the Ukraine. They didn't really know much about it. It's very vaguely impinged on their lives. But now they've all of a sudden, because everybody else seems to be saying the same thing, it's a political death for anybody in this country now, if they're a local councillor for a political party, to start asking questions about what is going on in the Ukraine. The Ukrainian government is very, very repressive. They've killed thousands of people. The Medvedchuk, who's just been swapped in this prisoner swap, he was the leader of the opposition in the Ukrainian parliament. But he's been treated as if he's a prisoner of war to be handed over to the Russians, because in actual fact he'd been brutalised in prison in Ukraine as the leader of the opposition. The Ukraine is not a democratic state. It's actually a failed state propped up by NATO. And
being destroyed by NATO,
being destroyed, that's right. The military infrastructure is being preserved, but the population are being pulverized. Yeah. And you know, Lavrov is, I mean, Lavrov is appealing there to what used to be called Westphalian principles, which is that the bigger states and the smaller states get equal representation in international bodies. And they get equal, you know, small states shouldn't be bullied around by big states.
Okay, Martin, well, we're going to wind up with a couple of clips, both around about 5 minutes. First of all, as I've been doing the last few weeks, looking at some really interesting, I think, anyway, documentaries, which are the sort of things that back in the old days would have been on the TV. Now they are, they're not even on YouTube because, as I said earlier, my Public Inquiry YouTube channel's been shut down this week with 12.5 million views, 26,000. Subscribers, 1,400 or 500 videos on there over the last 15 years, and everything is being censored by these tech giants, the Googles of this world. But anyway, this one is up on other channels, and not Google, or YouTube. So this is an extract from The Greatest Reset, where it looks at Trump and his use of chloroquine. And actually, this can be a proper cure. And here we hear the wonderful voice of Vladimir Zelenko, the doctor that died about 6 weeks, 2 months ago, who was Trump's doctor.
With President Trump telling the world he is now taking hydroxychloroquine, the local doctor who may have inspired him to take it is now reacting. CBS2's Carolyn Gusoff has the story.
We first told you about Dr. Zelenko last month. He says he's treated now 600 high-risk patients with only two deaths. His combination of meds, zinc, plus the anti-malaria drug hydroxychloroquine, and in some cases, antibiotics.
I got a letter from a doctor the other day. He just said, sir, I have hundreds of patients, and I give them hydroxychloroquine.
I didn't choose COVID. It chose me because the community that I was working in the first week of March had an outbreak, and it was the largest outbreak in America at the time. I just felt it was my duty, my moment. I'm not a soldier, but this was the moment that I was called upon to hold the line, and if you recall, at that time there was no treatment. The only emphasis was on building more hospitals, more hospital capacity, ICUs, respirators. 80% of the people on respirators were dying. So what I did in the second week of March, I started brushing up on my virology. I studied how this virus works. And then I looked at other countries. I looked how China and South Korea treated their patients. My treatment is based not on magic, but on hard science. And what did I use? Well, I just combined the French approach with hydroxychloroquine and azithromycin with the South Korean approach of zinc and hydroxychloroquine. And these are all drugs that I've used for 20 years. So my data showed an 84% reduction in hospitalization and death in high-risk patients if you use the Zelenko protocol. What that means, just to give you a sense of scale, if, let's say, 500,000 people had died, we could have prevented 420,000. I'll say that again. Out of 500,000 people, dead people, we could have prevented 420,000 from going to the hospital.
Under oath, on November 19th, in the 2020, in the U.S. Senate, I testified at that time, half of the deaths were preventable. Half.
I'm a little angry at the forces that have orchestrated this. And let me be very specific. First of all, the biggest culprits here are the academic fraudsters. Those people that provided the fraudulent data that was used as a basis to commit mass murder. Obstacles were created so the patients can't get life-saving medication.
All of those trials show consistently that hydroxychloroquine is not effective in the treatment of coronavirus disease or COVID-19.
The first study that came out that began the academic fraud cascade was the VA study, which showed the following, that hydroxychloroquine usage did not help and maybe even killed people. And you know what? They were right. There's one little detail they forgot to tell you.
Yes, the study shows the drug was ineffective in keeping patients off ventilators. And even more disturbing, it shows there was an increased chance in death.
The study documented those given the medication had a 95% higher risk of death.
What it showed that hydroxychloroquine, with or without azithromycin, didn't change at all whether or not you were put on a ventilator.
The study was done on patients on average 17 days in the hospital, all on ventilators. So the nefarious component was they took that conclusion in patients that are at the end stage of a disease process and extrapolated it to the pre-hospital setting, saying that you shouldn't use hydroxychloroquine early in the disease process. That's evil. That's not a conclusion that could have been made from that study.
Yeah, he's saying, using the word evil quite right, I think, to distort things in such a manner that are going to cause tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people to die, and preventing treatment, basic treatment, which Donald Trump got and then was ridiculed. And this is a coordinated disinformation campaign designed to kill people. And that's what we're looking at now, I'm afraid, in the Western press. This is why I start off the program and finish it too by talking about the psycho in the corner. I mean, it's just like there's some kind of psychopath sitting there chatting away with us. But of course, there is a massive amount of hope around as well. And one of those talking about that sort of thing is Dr. John Gideon Hartnett. I mean, I did an interview with him, which is now up on BitChute, and it's on this show page, certainly from last week. I think I can put this up again on this week's, if you like, which is a long interview. I think it's nearly an hour and a half, something like that, with this retired physics professor from, he's a teacher, I'm not sure, a scientist anyway, from Australia. And I first came across him on a terrific blog post where he talked about Yuval Noah Harari, the transhumanist Israeli, as the false prophet. He's saying that this guy is just coming out with all the stuff that people like Bill Gates and all of the rest of the elite who are in this globalist cult, that they just trot out what Yuval Noah Harari says, which I find fascinating, that these people don't think for themselves. They just read a Yuval Noah Harari book and they think they know it all. Well, of course, false prophecy. And the banks, then what they're doing is they're funding these things that he's talking about in his book, which is a self-fulfilling prophecy. So even a self-fulfilling false prophecy. So we'll wind up by listening to the second of several clips I've pulled out of the longer interview with John Gideon Hartnett, entitled Genetic Entropy, which is a fascinating concept in itself. He's a creation scientist, and he's one of those people that talks about intelligent design. We seem to have forgotten, he says, that science gets it wrong.
There's all the fraudulent side of it, which we don't need to go into, but that has been cropping up over the last few decades. In fact, some years ago, I was reading an article in Nature magazine, which is probably the leading science journal on Earth, and they were documenting how the amount of fraud that does occur in research journals is accelerating. It's almost off the charts. And in the fields of medical science, physiology, and these sort of drug development type sciences, fraud is really major. But having said that, what about those that is not fraudulent, where they claim the science was sound? And in the past, we pretty well all of us know about the failures of thalidomide, the morning sickness drug that was given to pregnant women back in the 50s, total failure. But there's other ones that are very, very remarkable. Doctors used to prescribe cigarettes, tobacco to patients for, like nervousness and this sort of thing. And yet that's a failure of science because the unknowns were not ruled out. It's the same thing with these COVID vaccines. No one's done any long-term studies. Well, it's the same thing back then with smoking. And then also doctors prescribed heroin That was common. Opium was common. The stimulants like the amphetamines as for weight loss and things like that. And then moving even further back into the 1800s, they prescribed mercury, liquid mercury, as a pretty much a cure-all. And yet, that's one of the most toxic materials on earth and would send people insane, I mean, causing all sorts of damage. And then in modern times, we've had this massive uptick in the occurrence of autism. Some people have calculated that we're on an exponential trajectory. Like going back, say, 50 years, there's almost no incidence of autism amongst the population. And then we see as the childhood vaccine schedule has been increased, and I think children now are getting up to something like 70-something shots for about 16 different vaccines, we see now autism accelerating. And one researcher I read about calculates that exponential growth to give us a 1 in 2 autism rate amongst boys by the year 2035. I mean, that is really scary stuff. I had a science teacher. A teacher anyway. He was over my house the other day and he was talking about his history in teaching here in the high schools. He's been there 40 years and he said in the early days they had no autistic children in the classrooms. But now at his school they have as many special ed teachers, that's those who care for the handicapped children, as normal teachers. It's an equal number. So back 40 years ago, there was hardly any need for such teachers. And then moving on to the COVID shots. I mean, this is a massive failure. I mean, this on proportions that is almost, you know, one can't even, it's hard to make oneself even believe it's true. But we're seeing by some calculations, for example, the United States, which has their VAERS, their Vaccine Adverse Events Reporting System, in tens of thousands being reported as died after the vaccine shots, and yet I think it's a MIT or a Harvard study found that may only be reporting about 1% or a few percent of the actual adverse events. And, of course, there's millions of non-death adverse events as well. So it looks like these COVID shots are causing a mass depopulation event. But really, I think the real agenda with them is not, well, maybe you might say it is mass depopulation, but it's definitely some form of surveillance because we don't know what's in them, and different researchers are using microscopy methods and other scientific methods, particularly a team in Germany. They are discovering pretty wild stuff in them, like self-assembling circuits and things like this that maybe is part of a future surveillance state system. Now, I would say compared to a few decades ago, the failures in the medical science realm were small compared to what's been happening now in the last year and a half. I think this is off the charts.
Well, last week we heard from John Gideon Hartnett, doctor, that of physics, that the whole business of COVID was, well, actually, no, last week we were talking about scientism, weren't we? And he's talking about it there as well, this whole idea of science becoming religion. And, of course, this is what the transhumanists are doing, is science is becoming a religion. We have to believe what the scientists tell us. And it's fascinating, isn't it, to hear him just repeating these facts that year after year after year, time after time after time, it's wrong. And I started off just before that clip, I was talking to him about the Piltdown Man, this whole idea of, the missing link being, just faked, forged, and for decades being accepted as the truth, even though it didn't exist at all. So That's Creation Scientist. We'll be hearing more from him, Dr. John Gideon Hartnett, over the next few weeks. But the entire interview is up there for you to listen to now. I'll put it up with on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Next week, we'll be having a pretty close look at China. I'm going to play some stuff from the Chinese ambassador to the UN, or I'm not sure exactly who he is, Chinese somebody appointed by the Pope of China, President Xi, at the United Nations. And we'll be also talking to and hearing from Finian Cunningham, who's just been over going on these trains on the Chinese Belt and Road Initiative trains, which are linking up all these countries in Indochina. So that's for next week. But for now, time to sign off. Thanks to our guest, Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers, and also to Bernard Kennedy from ASLEF, the Train Drivers Union, based here in Bristol, branch secretary until recently when he retired, and to Henry Widdus, chair of the branch of North West Lancashire branch of the National Union of Journalists, and also to sound engineer Dave Bazanko. I apologise for not actually crediting him in the last couple of weeks. We couldn't do it without you, Dave. Download our MP3s to listen in the car or anywhere you like. Do please send me interviews and story tips via Not the BCFM Politics Show page, where you'll also find the podcast, full-length interviews, story links, comment page, and our email addresses. You can subscribe or unsubscribe from my weekly email list, which goes out usually on a Sunday evening, and even donate at thisweekoneword.org.uk. I'm shadow banned on Twitter at Tony Gosling. I'm also completely banned from YouTube on my public inquiry channel. That is 12.5 million views, 1,500 videos, and 26,000 subscribers, all vanished in the blink of an eye. Make sure you have a listen to and look at my existing channel, the Peter Berenius channel, before they take that out too, with their big guns, their naval guns, smashing my little ship on the ocean, which was called Public Inquiry, now gone. But that that, yeah, I kind of always knew it would happen at some point. But yeah, it's quite I'll let you know if the appeal gets anywhere, which it won't. My paperbacks about deals between the Allies and the Nazis during the war, the Bilderbergers and the Battle of Arnhem, that is called The Traitors of Arnhem, that's £15. Also my secret government anthology from Cromwell to the Princess Diana assassination, The Siege of Heaven Reader. You can download those, or the copy is £30 at the moment, so I've hardly got any of those left. That is The Siege of Heaven Reader, the paperbacks. This show is repeated at 11 p.m. on Fridays, and at 11 and 5 a.m. and p.m. all week on this PRSC stream, except when we're restreaming the Richie Allen Show. And it's also on over Sunday lunch at Camberley's Radio QUK.com. Do feel free, please, to make live recordings and to upload clips, etc., as long as you link back to here. We've been streaming live from the People's Republic of Stokescroft in Bristol, and also on the talkradio.org.uk stream if you want to go straight to it to listen on online live. Have a play with the apps. If you've got an iPhone, and the Apple show, Apple App Store, there we are. It's called Not the BCFM Politics Show app, and it's also available via our show page at thisweek.org.uk. You'll find a little link to there on each week's show. And please don't use Google at all unless you absolutely have to. Well, you don't have to. There's always something else you can use. Censorship and military disinformation is sadly the norm in the UK today, thanks to the collaborators who own the transmitters and printing presses, most of them at least, apart from the one that Mark Stein uses, Stein, I think he calls himself, doesn't he, on GB News during the week in the early evenings. If you can restream us live or rebroadcast, just let us know and I'll credit you here. Have a relaxing an enjoyable weekend. Do join us at 5 o'clock next Friday if you can at talkradio.org.uk live for Not the BCFM Politics Show. God bless, and don't let Basel's Illuminati banksters get you down.
You can run on for a long time, run on for a long time, run on for a long time. Sooner or later gotta cut you down, sooner or later gotta cut you down. Go tell that long-tongued liar Go and tell that midnight rider, tell the rambler, the gambler, the backbiter, tell him that God's gonna cut him down. Tell him that God's gonna cut him down. Well, my goodness gracious, let me tell you the news. My head's been wet with the midnight dew. I've been down on bended knee, talking to the man from Galilee. He spoke to me with a voice so sweet, I thought I heard the shuffle of angels' feet. He called my name and my heart stood still when he said, John, go do my will. Go tell that long-tongued liar, go and tell that midnight rider, tell the rambler, the gambler, the backbiter, tell him that God's gonna cut him down. Tell him that God's gonna cut him down. You can run on for a long time, run on for a long time, run on for a long time. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down. Well, you may throw your rock, hide your hand, working in the dark against your fellow man. But as sure as God made black and white, what's done in the dark will be brought to the light. You can run on for a long time, run on for a long time, run on for a long time. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down. Go tell that long-tongued liar, go and tell that midnight rider, tell the rambler, the gambler, the backbiter, tell him that God's gonna cut you down. Tell him that God's gonna cut you down. Tell him that God's gonna cut you down.